That's a little much.
Okay, it wasn't really good. Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for April 3rd, 2013 will come to order. We have a very full agenda today, and we're going to try to get through all the bills. We're going to try and do this in the order of non-committee members going first, so which is why Senator Reiner is sitting there, and hopefully get to the members that are on the committee at the end. May be some people from out of town, so we may have to move some things around, and we do have a couple of authors that might be missing, so there could be some other authors presenting some bills here. I would urge testifiers today to try and keep their testimony short, as we have a lot of bills to be heard, and at the very least, try not to repeat what the person before you said, so we don't have to hear the same thing twice from two different people. I realize that everybody's testimony is just as important as everybody else's, so I want you to give us your testimony. But like I said, if you can refrain from repeating, that would be great. And so let's start out right away with Senator Reinhart and Senate File 1352.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File.
A quorum is present.
Senate File 1352. Mr. Chairman, I have the first three, and I've cautioned all of my testifiers that we have 5 minutes or less, or you will gavel them down. Or worse, Senator Ingebretson will scowl at them. So we'll stick right to it.
You know I'd never do that.
Senator Reiner, maybe you should be running this committee.
Don't give me ideas, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1352, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is a project for a public theater space in downtown Duluth, and this is a project that will host a multiple number of arts organizations that have regional and statewide impact, as well as regional and statewide audiences. So I've got one handout. Actually, Mr. Chair, we have the A1 amendment, if we could adopt that. Someone would be so kind as to move it for me.
Senator Schmidt moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that Senator Reiner would like it to be in. So all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Yep. Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, hopefully members you have, there's a handout that shows all the uses and sources for this project. One of the things you'll hear in the couple minutes of testimony is that we've got a much bigger project that's about a block of frontage in downtown Duluth. This theater space is one public portion of a larger private development. So many of us have talked and are supportive of public-private ventures, and this truly is one. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would invite Christine Seitz from the Duluth Playhouse to talk more in detail, and also want to introduce committee members to Mayor Don Ness from Duluth, who will share some comments as well.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Seitz. Just say your name.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Christine Grottle Seitz. I'm the director of the Duluth Playhouse, and I represent the partnership with the City of Duluth for the restored historic North Shore Theater. The Duluth Playhouse has been serving the Northeast region for over 100 years. We're a deeply rooted, financially sound arts organization that receives tremendous region-wide support. In addition to the Playhouse, Duluth supports a growing number of performing arts groups that include a professional symphony, a professional ballet, and an opera company, all of which serve a patron base that includes the vast Northeast region. However, it's important to also note that Duluth actually doesn't have a dedicated community arts center that can support these flourishing arts groups that have region-wide impact in our area. I'm honored to be partnering with the City of Duluth to realize this compelling vision for a restored North Shore that will be a community and a regional performing arts center that currently does not exist in our area. This North Shore will play a very significant role, and not just in the arts and the economic development of our downtown area, especially for the neighboring businesses and restaurants and bars and parking lots. And a restored North Shore will provide jobs, it will attract tourism, and it will stimulate further investments in Duluth. The North Shore, when it is restored, will be a mid-sized house that does not exist currently in our part of the state. And this is important. This mid-sized venue that is necessary for our community will allow us to bring in regional and national acts that currently skip Duluth as a destination because of the lack of an appropriate size venue. It is and will be the home that the local arts community has been dreaming of. We're very excited about the potential of the North Shore for our community and for the region. It has been an icon for more than a century, and it's time for it to come back to life so that it can serve our region for generations to come. We respectfully ask for your support. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Mayor, do you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of this important project. Senator Reinert said it correctly. This is a great example
Mayor,
of a
public. Mayor, say your name for the record, please.
Oh, Mayor Don Ness from Duluth. Senator Reinert was correct. This is a tremendous example of a public-private partnership. I just want to give a little background. Over the past decade, in a three-block radius around the North Shore, we've seen $100 million worth of investment, private investment, in this area. There are two sites within a block of the North Shore that were major problems and threatened that private investment. One that you may have read about in the paper is the Last Place on Earth, which this gentleman is selling synthetic drugs and is the bane of our downtown, but we are doing everything that we can to fix that problem. The other was the North Shore Theater. The North Shore Theater is an iconic structure in our downtown, but it was being neglected. The roof, the previous owner laid carpet and then put tires on top of the carpet as his roof. Obviously, that's not effective, and there was a tremendous amount of water damage coming into it. The theater was being used as a strip club. There were gang activity, drug activity, and prostitution being run out of the last remaining historic theater, and putting the private investment in downtown Duluth at risk because of the activity at the Last Place on Earth and at the North Shore. The city took a risk because we saw the importance of this structure and the potential that it has to serve the entire region for the arts. We purchased it and then have been working closely with the Playhouse and Sherman Associates to revitalize this project. This is a project that is shovel ready to go under construction this fall with the state's support. Will represent a tremendous leverage of private dollars to the public state dollars that are being requested.
Okay. Did I see you're putting the tower back up on it, too?
Yes, that's correct.
Are there any questions for either Senator Reinert or any of the witnesses? So is this an entire gutting of it? Is that basically is and redoing it?
It's a complete rehabilitation of the theater.
Okay, and I see just for the committee's attention, the amendment changed the non-state sources commitment from 3-1 to 2-1. Is that correct?
Correct.
So I just want everybody to be aware of that. Are there any questions for anybody? Okay. Any further comments from either one?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, then we'll lay Senate File 1352 over for possible inclusion in the recommendation for the bonding committee. Thank you very much, Ms. Seitz, for coming along.
Thank you.
Are you sticking around for one more?
Two more. Wade Stadium, Craig Smith. So, Mr. Chairman, the next bill that I have,
Senate File 1150.
I have an author's amendment on that one as well.
Okay. Senator Schmidt will offer the A1 amendment to Senate File 1150 to put the bill in the shape the author would like it to be. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we get started, we're talking about Wade Stadium, which is a historical ballpark in Duluth. It's a Works Progress Administration project. Some of us, especially Northlanders, will know that the stadium was in the news the week before last because part of the wall actually fell down due to freezing and thawing over the now 60-plus years that the stadium's been in existence. So members of this committee, some members will remember that we've had this project before us in the past. So we're back to talk a little bit about it again and give you an update on the current status. So, Mr. Chair, I'll ask Terry Ryla from the City of Duluth, who's kind of the lead architect on this project, to talk a little bit about it. And then we also have Craig Smith, who is with the Duluth Huskies baseball team, to speak a little bit about it.
Senator Reiner, what year did Danny McLean pitch there?
Mid to late 60s.
I didn't know there was going to be a quiz.
Mid 60s.
Because I saw him pitch. I was at a game where Danny McLean
before
was
I was born, Mr. Chairman.
That's a good answer.
Is that the right answer? I'm told 1967, Mr. Chairman. I just pulled that out of my memory.
No, I think that's too early or too late. I mean, I think it was earlier than that.
Yeah,
I think it might be 64 or 65. Because when did he get 30 wins in Detroit in 1968? Wasn't that the year he won?
I can't remember.
Yeah, we should Google it.
Huh?
Or a Google.
You got to Google it, I think.
We'll have to Google it, yeah.
While we find that out, Mr. Chair, I'll ask Terry to talk a little bit about the project.
Who wants to go first?
Terry is.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, hello. I'm Terry Ryla, an architect for the City of Duluth. I work in facility management, and I see firsthand the condition of Wade Stadium. I know and I deal with the unfortunate consequences of deferred maintenance. And like many others, I have a vision for how great the Wade could be again. The Wade was built in 1941, one of three remaining WPA stadiums in use. The historically significant, beautiful red brick building has definitely seen better days. Today, the Wade has deteriorated brick joints that cause water damage inside the building. That exterior brick wall that recently fell, it was kind of a momentous event for us. It is secured. We are in no danger to anyone with that collapse. The lack of the field draining system in our northern climate doesn't allow for the grass to establish itself before the season starts. Half of the games played at the Wade are before the growing season. If ever there was a candidate for artificial turf, it would be the Wade. The concession stands are too confined in a narrow concourse. By today's standards, the concession equipment is obsolete and the walk-in cooler is no longer acceptable by the state health department. All the building utilities services need to be updated to meet standard codes, including the wiring, plumbing, and drainage. And here's our opportunity to incorporate energy-saving measures throughout, including energy-efficient stadium lights. So why am I talking to you about some small ball field up in Duluth? Because that ball field is a big deal to Duluth and the surrounding region. We have over 20 active users of the Wade, from the Duluth Huskies to area schools to concerts to community events. A lot of people use the Wade, and a lot of people visit the Wade, maybe some of you. And maybe people remember when the stadium was in better repair and the pride of Duluth. So thank you for your support.
So we have an update. Danny McLean pitched there in 1963.
And he's coming up this summer again to visit us. So
I'd love to see him.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we can make that happen.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Craig Smith, General Manager of the Duluth Huskies. I'm here to represent the user groups that utilize this facility from Grand Marais down through St. Cloud. It's the only enclosed athletic facility that the City of Duluth owns. And we've been working closely with the City of Duluth to partner to ensure that any project that may or may not be done is inclusive of not interfering with the groups that use the facility. Our operational situation is pretty dire in the fact that it needs to be upgraded in order to be able to, you know, make enough money to be self-supportive without user groups having to ask for free rent, those types of things. It needs to be upgraded, Terry's concession facilities, and but more than anything is the field itself. It's unsafe. We've got the field itself has sunk dramatically over the last several years to make it actually the water sits on the field. We've had to cancel games because of it. Players are running through soft spots to hard spots, which creates some obvious lower body injuries for not only us, but all the way down to 13-year-old children that are playing out of that stadium. So we hope to get your support. We're very supportive of what the city's trying to do to help fund this, and look for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for anybody? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Reinhart for bringing this forward. A couple of questions, maybe directed toward the about the user group. You have a list of schools on here, high schools, Marshall High School. Do they play all their season on this ball field, or would that be the intention, or are we talking regional-type games? Or
It's all of the above, to be quite frank, sir. It's College of St. Scholastica uses all of their home games there. The Duluth-Denfeld High School uses all their home games there. Marshall and East use the facility to host out-of-town teams because that's where they want to play. We've had Nashua, Keewatin, Hill City, Solon Springs, Northwestern, Shandling, North Dakota played a home game at Wade Stadium last spring. So this is a regional facility that's going to not only be able to host more games because artificial turf allows us to play unlimited use, whereas we've had to limit the use because of the natural turf not. The grass isn't growing when all these games are occurring. So, yes, this is a regional facility that we hope to go beyond just baseball, community events, soccer, fall sports, those types of things. So it's a great question. Thank you.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. And how many seats would you add here on this renovation program?
There would be no addition of seats. It actually would be a reduction of seats based on some of the press box facility that needs to be upgraded. Probably the loss of about 800 seats. So probably about 2,800 seats would be utilized in this facility. From a Duluth Huskies perspective, we average right now about 1,300 fans per game. Our goal is to get up to 1,800. So this will facilitate our needs as well as everybody else's needs for special events.
Thank you.
To add to the list of teams that played there, 1971 Chisholm played there, just so you know. I was catching it. We were pretty excited about going to Wade Stadium to play the game. So, Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then that
were
would
you born
create
in
a
19, were you born in 1971? Or
I was prior. Yeah, I was okay, here in 1971. Right. But I don't know if that's a conflict of interest now that you played there. So I don't know. I do have a question.
Don't worry.
Is there a statue?
I'm still from Chisholm.
There is a difference, right?
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Reinhart, at some point in time, I start to wonder about facilities that have grown to the point where, or have aged to the point where they're no longer useful. In the original request, which was a paltry $250,000 compared to where we're going with this, it was to, I think, do a design to see if this is a functional stadium, perhaps, or if it's time for us to cut the cord and move on. Is that where we're at here? Is this something where we would actually be able to do this better, cheaper, with a brand new facility as opposed to rehabilitating an existing facility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmek, great question. I'll answer a part, and then I'll let Ms. Riala speak to that as well. The study design is actually engineering documents, so it's step one in construction phase. So I think from our standpoint, that determination's already been made that it's much more cost efficient to fix what we have versus build new. But I'll let the architect, not the talking head, speak to this.
Ms. Riala.
It's true. The historic nature of the building, of the facilities, really calls for us to take care of what we already have. And it's not so far gone. It's still in workable condition. It makes much more economic sense to reuse what we already have. If the funding doesn't ever come through, we'll just keep hanging in there, band-aiding what we can to make do with what we have. But it's that kind of postponing of repair work that has gotten us into the shape that we're in right now. So.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I guess I didn't feel that I got an answer out of that. I guess at some point in time, facilities become outdated to the point of unusable. Is it safe to say that what you're saying is that the facility right now is in a rehabilitation state where it would make economic sense, it would be more expensive for you to level it, as much as I'm sure the chair would not like to see one of his ball fields go where he played on? Is it much more economically viable for us to rehabilitate the facility as opposed to starting from scratch?
From my professional opinion, I would say rehabbing is the way to go. That is the most sustainable approach. If you don't have to build new, you save that much more money. If we were to build new, I don't know that we would actually build a stadium as much as a ball field with bleacher system. Here we have a historic structure, a historic facility in place. It just needs some tweaking and a little TLC.
And for the record, the chair doesn't have any opinion upon whether or not they knock it down and build a new one or just fix this one because I played there in 1971.
However, Mr. Chair, if they named it Tomasotti Stadium, I guess you would have an opinion.
That weed guy might be upset, though.
Yes. And as the chair pointed out, he's from Chisholm.
Yes. Senator Saxhawk.
Well, I think it's a good location. It's easy to get to, and it's one of the few flat places in Duluth.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Just to point out so Senator Reinhart or maybe Ms. Ryla, the language in the bill that talks about fields drainage, that's in relation to the artificial turf and everything also, correct? And then there's a $1 of non-state money committed to every $250 of state money. Just to point out for the committee. Is there a problem raising local money? Is that why it's not one-to-one?
Mr. Chairman, I think the city has several tactics they'd like to pursue in raising the local match. And you know, the Mayor Ness is still here as well. The city is looking at doing this in a couple steps. So the design and engineering documents that were in the original bill, as well as the full development funds that I have requested in my amendment, both of which would be necessary in order to carry the fund out. But I think using some existing resources we already have, including potentially some hotel-motel uses, I mean, that is, for those who have been to Duluth, the Wade is in the heart of a recreational part of town. Nearby, we have Wheeler Field, which is a 4-5-field softball complex that the city maintains. A few blocks away, we have the Heritage Sports Complex, which is 2 sheets of ice hockey and has become the hockey, Mr. Chairman, the hockey ground zero.
For the record, I never played there.
In Duluth. Yeah. So.
Not yet.
Right. So we've seen a resurgence of that activity in that western part of town. So I think we have the revenue streams necessary to take care of the city's contribution.
Okay. All right. With that, then, we'll lay over Senate File 1150 for possible inclusion for a recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck in this season, too.
Thank you, sir.
I look forward to seeing you at a game, Mr. Chairman.
I'm coming.
Just because it's such a treat to be with you, Mr. Chairman. Third.
You're doing really good, by the way. Senator File 709.
I notice I'm getting laid over. I've got a third bill. This one we're familiar with because we've heard it several times. And this, committee members, I'm going to take you back a little bit. My first year in the legislature was 2009 in the House. And my very first bill, actually the first bill passed by a freshman, which means absolutely nothing, was to allow Spirit Mountain to use water from St. Louis Bay to make snow instead of chlorinated city water, which is the current system. And we got that permission change through. So the request you have before you is to actually take care of the infrastructure necessary for Spirit Mountain to do that, to actually draw water from St. Louis Bay, make snow with it, let it melt and run off the hill back into the bay. A much more closed loop, much more environmentally sustainable system. So to talk with you about that is Renee Mattson, the executive director of the Spirit Mountain Recreational Authority. And members, I would just point out that it is a state authority, Spirit Mountain.
Ms. Mattson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Reiner, for that introduction. Members of the committee, I'm very appreciative to have this opportunity to describe in more detail Senate File 709. As Senator Reiner stated, the project we're proposing has multiple ways.
Ms. Mattson, I know we already said your name, but just for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Renee Mattson, Executive Director at Spirit Mountain.
Okay, thanks.
This project has multiple ways in which it does benefit Duluth, and particularly our winter tourism economy and ultimately Spirit Mountain. The Grand Avenue corridor in West Duluth, which is anchored by Spirit Mountain, has been identified as a tourism corridor for future development. And land has already been acquired around Spirit Mountain by private developers that support that vision. So removing Spirit Mountain from Duluth's water system is a very prudent move. Spirit Mountain's economic success will directly affect the economic success of multiple businesses that are going to be built in that area in the future. This is an endeavor, as Senator Reinert mentioned, that we've been working on for more than 5 years. It's a project which has the enthusiastic support of the City of Duluth, the Minnesota DNR, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. It's important to note that Spirit Mountain has a direct economic impact on the region of $37 million annually. Ensuring there's a viable water supply every fall is extremely important, and it's not necessarily a given. With Duluth's aging infrastructure, supporting this improvement makes sense economically and environmentally. With the new attractions that we've been able to complete on our own by means of traditional bank loans, we've been able to increase our year-round benefit-eligible workforce by 89%. This project, though, is simply beyond our means because there's no direct revenue to pay for this project from Spirit Mountain. So we need the assistance of the state to offset the cost of the project. But we have already secured $1 million in grants with the help of the previously mentioned partners to complete a watershed study, engineering, and substantial groundwork already. So a bonding support for this project would enable us to fully finish this project and leverage our grant dollars towards completion. So in all of the projects, this truly is a shovel-ready project, and I'm very grateful to have the time to talk with you about this and ask for your support and certainly answer any questions you might have about this project.
Thank you, Ms. Mattson. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, before if Mayor Ness could just say a few words on this project.
Mayor,
as well.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, Mayor Don Ness from Duluth. The common thread between these three programs is the age of our infrastructure in the City of Duluth. And in each of these three projects, we're investing in existing infrastructure and the existing amenities that we have. Right now, we draw our water, drinking water, from Lake Superior. And then, as a city very long and linear, as well as built upon a hill, we spend a tremendous amount of resources pumping that water across town. Spirit Mountain is on the opposite end of town from our water station, and is very expensive and puts a tremendous amount of stress on our water system during those weeks that they're making snow. This is a more environmentally friendly project, drawing directly from the river. It's actually better water for making snow because it has a little grit to it, and that helps in the snow-making process. And we're not then sending treated water, fluorinated water, back into the St. Louis River during the snow melt. So it's a good project, and we very much support Spirit Mountain's efforts to make it a year-round recreation destination.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in recent proposals, and I'm not sure who can answer this question, but in recent proposals coming from the DNR, I know you said you had the DNR support. My question would be, if and when this is up and running, we're going to be drawing water out of the St. Louis River. Right now, the DNR is talking about raising fees for water fees in the state of Minnesota. I'm wondering how that would play out once this is all completed, and if you have prepared for those types of costs. I don't know if the DNR, I don't want to waste a whole lot of your time, Mr. Chair, but I know that's certainly an issue of water is one of our resources, obviously our great resources right now, and where there's a shortage of it. And I guess my question is, if you have good snow years, that's one thing, but if you don't, you got to make snow for this. And are you prepared for the cost that the DNR is putting on producers and everybody else in the state as well?
Well, actually, like all Midwestern resorts, we depend on man-made snow for virtually all of our product. Natural snowfall is wonderful, but it does not do anything towards putting snow on our slopes. All of the snow that we make comes from Lake Superior already, so having this pipe into the St. Louis River for us, simply, as the mayor stated, takes us from taking the water 26 miles across town to a pipe that's only 2,000 feet from our front door. And it would enable us to make snow in half the time. So in addition to the savings for us of using city-treated water, it's an enormous savings to us to get off that system. So if there is a cost with the DNR, and I don't know what those fees are going to be, it's likely less expensive, far less expensive than it is for us to take treated city water for our use.
And Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's all relative to whether or not those fees actually pass the legislature.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I do see somebody from the DNR here, and I just don't know what that cost would be, but I would certainly caution you moving forward to get some numbers on that if the fees are going to be increased elsewhere in the state for our water resources that are becoming very precious now. Frankly, I think it's a cycle, and I think we're going to be fine. But nonetheless, right now we're down. We're low. And just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Senator Reinert or Senator?
Nothing else,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, I appreciate that. And we'll lay Senate File 709 over for possible inclusion and recommendation.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being brief, Senator Reinert. For any new Senate authors who may have walked in while we were making the announcements earlier on, we have a full agenda today, so if you can be concise and have your testifiers not try and repeat what the one before them said, and we can get through this agenda without any problem. We're going to go to Senate File 80, Senator Peterson. Two St. Cloud senators.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we have before you Senate File 80, which is the River's Edge Convention Center. This is a sixth consecutive year that this project has appeared before the legislature. This facility request has not changed at all, really, since our first request back in 2008. From the city, and neither has the source of the local funds that have already been invested in this project. In fact, I testified for this project as a city council member back in 2009 and has continued to work on it diligently since then. It's important to note that this project has been supported by the St. Cloud Legislative Delegation in a very bipartisan manner. My predecessor was a very bipartisan manner. I am a bipartisan man as well, as I spoke, but Senator Clark, whose seat I filled, was supportive of this project, and Representative Howes, who was replaced by Representative Banyan, and now Representative Dorholt, and now Gutwalt and Tice in the House as well, have all supported this project. And so it's important to note that we have a broad-based community support. Private sector support as well. Each year we've been to the Capitol since 2008 to bring this request before you. Each time either the governor or the legislature has supported the project, but unfortunately never both at the same time. And so we're back for you today, and we hope that this year is our year. We have a couple guests that I'll allow to introduce themselves as we move forward, and allow them to share with you their role in terms of this project as well. So,
I think, Senator Peterson, I voted for this project about four or five different times now. I just can't believe it's still here. Could have sworn we did it.
Yep. Mr. Chair, you're one or two votes ahead of me then, but I'm right behind you. So,
who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Kleiss, Mayor of the City of St. Cloud.
Former Senator, did you vote for it when you were here?
I did. In fact, Mr. Chair, interesting, the project is no different than it was in 2008. I was actually mayor in 2008, but I originally carried an expansion when I was in the legislature that we actually passed the legislature, but was vetoed by Governor Ventura. At that time, and we're so it's been around even before, but the project that's before you is exactly the same as the project that was brought forward in 2008. It has not changed. We haven't added or subtracted anything, with the exception of, in 2008, and this is important to note, that 2008 we actually did receive some bonding dollars from the legislature. That was a year that the legislature and the administration were together, and we received $2 million that was passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Pawlenty. That was it was the additional dollars to basically site preparation, land acquisition. It went a little above and beyond what the normal prep dollars were. We actually it was $2 million from the state, $2 million local match. We matched that with that $4 million. We bought some buildings. We moved some businesses. We closed a road. We ended up moving some utilities. So we put quite a bit of commitment based on the commitment that the state had at that time, anticipating coming back in 2010 and finishing the project off. We came back in 2010, and unfortunately that did not prevail. And we were left with a very difficult decision as a city. We had already moved some businesses. We had a dirt parking lot. We're in the situation where we're, you know, in the middle of the recession. We could blame the legislature and just be angry, but we had to make a decision and go forward. And we made, I think, a financially prudent decision. We took advantage of some the economy and the low interest rates. And a good construction market. We squeezed absolutely the last penny that we possibly could out of our 1 cent food and beverage tax to go beyond what we. And again, when we were originally here in 2008, it was a $15 million request, $15 million local, $15 million state. We were able to squeeze out a $22 million locally. We made a decision to go forward with as much as we possibly could. And to make sure that what we went forward with was functional, but leaving out the parts that we could get by with for a little while, and then do later, and that's what we did. So we went forward with the construction. It's been open, the piece that we have. Since then, we've seen the economic impact that our studies showed that would be seen in our area with additional hotel renovation, downtown. Again, this is a significant part of our downtown, historic downtown district, and so we went forward with that. We have again come back to the legislature to finish that project off. Our request is less because of our ability to go forward. It's actually, when we were asking, it was a 50-50 split. Now it's a two-thirds local, one-third, and we're here, and we're going to keep coming here until we can finish it. Well, there's no way locally for us to finish this project. We did as much as we possibly could locally, and that's why we're here. This is about broad, as Senator Peterson said. It's had multiple all of our local areas have passed resolutions in support. So not just the city of St. Cloud, it's all the area cities, all of the bipartisan legislators that have served the area. But it is something very strongly supported by the business community. And again, we've seen already some of that impact. But we're in the point right now with the last piece that we need to finish. The parking facility, the Rivers feature, especially the parking facility that as we're successful. And again, we went forward because we had outgrown the facility had outgrown the community as far as the space needs. And this is a facility that is not subsidized by the property tax, but we were running the risk of that happening because we couldn't hold the conventions that we once were able to do because of the size. But we've seen a lot of expansion, and one of the expansions, I'll turn it over to Jim Graves, who used to own the hotel across the street, but probably can give his own perspective as how he expanded because of that. He also is the chair. We have an advisory committee of citizens that are experts in hospitality and business community and citizens in the community that are advising the administration and the council on the operation of the Rivers Edge Convention Center. And Jim Graves is the chair of that, so I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Chair.
Before you get started, just a question of the Mayor. Mayor, can I assume that this is ready to go? You don't need pre-design and design to be done.
This is beyond shovel-ready. It's two-thirds built. So it's the more ready to go that we can get going, we're ready to go and add the piece this spring yet, and we'd be able to have it finished by next year.
We have, just so you know, I don't know how she knew it, but as her name was being mentioned, former Senator Clark walked into the room. So we have like three St. Cloud senators here, and then we have an aspiring congressman at the table also. So this is all pretty interesting. So anyway, Mr. Greaves.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm here to represent the business community and also as chair of the advisory committee for the River Center. It's a very critical component to the downtown. It's a catalyst. It builds the energy that we need downtown, and without the parking facility and the completion of that, we're actually never going to really realize the ultimate need that we have for that center, because we just don't have the parking. I've been involved in the downtown since inception of the first phase, which is phase one, going back in the late 80s, and it's been very critical to have that convention facility for both our business community, our lodging community, and also our food and beverage community. And the city business community has been very supportive, always supported the 1% food and beverage tax, been very, very supportive of the city council and the mayor. And we're just here to ask you to help us finish this project. And downtown St. Cloud is in very much need of this facility to be completed, and we appreciate all of your support.
Okay. Any questions from the members of the committee? Any last comments, Senator Peterson? Okay. Next, we'll leave Senate File 80 over for possible inclusion and a recommendation to the body. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Senator Senjum. This is another one we've seen about 100 times.
Senjum's got glasses.
Senate File 342, Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee.
Proceed?
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 342 is a bonding request for $37 million for the expansion of Mayo Civic Center and related infrastructure, including skyways, lighting, parking, landscaping, et cetera, et cetera. You've been a little historical today, Mr. Chair, and the Mayo Civic Auditorium was originally built in 1937, a $450,000 gift from the Mayo Brothers, and I remember 1950, well, I hate to say this, but Roy Rogers and Trigger, and Roy was shooting silver dollars out of the sky, and they were, you know, bang, zing, they go, and so it's got lots of memories. Not unlike your Denny McClain. Yes.
What year?
I don't know.
I was there too.
The mayor was there as well. He could have.
Unlike today, with Senator Senjum shooting silver bullets out of his own gun. Is that?
Mr. Chair, for some of us not so gray-haired, Roy Rogers.
How do you know what color your hair is?
Yeah, good point.
The golden Palomino Trigger. More seriously, in 1990, what we call Taylor Arena, which probably some of you have been to if you've been to political conventions and so on, was dedicated and put into operation 22 years ago already. And that provides seating for 7,200 people and, of course, banquet facilities and things like that, albeit it is simply a large room with arena-style seating. So, and obviously a somewhat large floor, the largest in our city. As time has moved on and it's become ever apparent, Mayo Civic Center is a patchwork of different buildings that never really was built very well to accommodate conventions. There's but a few breakout rooms and things like that available there. It's a hodgepodge of things. And as we move forward, at least within this community, and you might hear some mention this session about Destination Medical Center and a renewed Rochester and a whole lot of activity happening in terms of economic development and a vibrant future, obviously a new civic center expansion at least is pretty important to that whole program. So as we think about this and where it's been, I believe in 2008, I believe that was the year we had approval for about, I think, $3.5 million worth of planning money those plans, I see them. They probably weigh 100 pounds, if not more. So they're already and have been ready for a couple of years. In 2010, the bill was vetoed. In 2012, it was a near miss with respect to the deed grant program. And so we are back, and I'll just stop there and turn it over to other testimony from our mayor and from our convention visitors bureau person, Brad Jones. But I'd like to turn it now over, if you would, Mr. Chair, to our mayor, Ardell Brady.
Is there not a hockey rink in here?
No, there used to be.
In the world.
A short one.
Hockey's life, you guys.
Mr. Chair, we used to have the Rochester Mustangs, Lou Nanny, and that whole group of people played in that arena, and it was a show to see.
And you're not going to have a hockey rink in it now?
What do we have in town now?
We have six ice surfaces, but we took it out of the Mayo Civic Center. So Graham Arena has four, and Rec Center has two.
Okay. All right.
If you'd like, Mr. Chair, we could up that by about a million and do that for you.
You may as well.
Thank you.
Who wants to go next, Mayor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ardell Brady, the mayor of Rochester. As we're talking about these things, and I was really curious about the ball game that's going to be up in Duluth with Denny McLean, I looked it up. It happens to be that the Rochester Honkers are playing the Duluth Huskies that day on Saturday, so I think I'm going to have to talk to the mayor up there and see if I can get tickets up there.
Well, there should be a bet, too, I would think.
Good idea. Good idea. We'll do that. Anyway, thank you so much for hearing us today. As has been mentioned, this project has been around for a few years, since 2007. We did receive that $3.5 million in design money. The plans are all ready to go. We could, in about 90 days, have construction started. 90% of the project costs will add $188,000 square feet of convention center, a ballroom, meeting rooms, not for entertainment or sports, that's already there. This medical-related convention space will improve the regional and state economy. Some of the numbers that are there, the area economic impact is $372 million over 10 years. Out-of-state economic impact, $120 million over 10 years. 713 construction jobs, hundreds of full-time jobs. And we've got full support from the community, the businesses, chamber, convention bureau, labor, Mayo Clinic. As was said, the request is for $37 million. It's about an $82 million project now, of which $45 million will come from the city. This predates the DMC project that's out there. It's separate, but it will be complementary. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Brad Jones from the Convention Bureau.
Welcome, Mr. Jones.
Hello, Mr. Chair and committee. Thanks for your time. Just to be very clear, this is convention center space that we need desperately. Our organization is in charge of sales and marketing. I'm sorry?
Just say your name.
Brad Jones, Executive Director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau in Rochester. Sorry. We are in charge of sales and marketing for the city, and we go and talk to a lot of these groups, the majority of which are medical, medicine, clinical related, and they would like to come to the state of Minnesota. Specifically, they'd like to be next to Mayo Clinic, and they would like to collaborate with those professionals who, by the way, serve on many of those national and international association boards. In dealing with them and bringing them to town, they all say the same thing. You have lovely hotels. You have lovely infrastructure. What you don't have that we need is a convention center. Ballroom quality. Very highly technical space in which they need to function in these meetings. So as a result, we also compete against the other national and international medical centers for these types of meetings and conventions. The Clevelands of the world, which as we speak are just finishing a $500 million project geared specifically toward this. Baltimore, Houston, Boston, San Diego, as you can understand. So, to illustrate that, we've track these numbers, and over the last 4 years, we've said no to about $85 million in direct spending. These groups wanted to come here. We didn't have the facility available for them, so they went elsewhere. We would like to go after those and more, bring them to the state of Minnesota, bring them to Rochester, and this leads to jobs. This leads to the next generation of workers that are interested in healthcare as a profession, and as you can see, the spinoff really goes on and on. We have the city, we have the infrastructure, and we need to get this done sooner rather than later, so it jives with our master plan and puts us in a position to really be effective in our global position within the economy. So that being said, I'll turn it over to our building trades, and they can articulate the need for this project in terms of jobs and the economy.
Mr. Chairman, committee, good afternoon. My name is Greg Andrist. I'm a delegate with the Southeast Minnesota Building Trades. We are representing the construction end of this project. We represent currently about 2,600 men and women in southeastern Minnesota ready to go to work. This particular project, we're estimating about 1 million man hours worth of labor. A lot of it will be on site. You'll have off-site work, off-site fabrication that will end up on this project. This should create roughly over 700 additional jobs in southeastern Minnesota. Our construction industry, it's not a big secret, we've hit some pretty low spots here. We've got men and women been sitting home, slowly coming back to work. They're looking for some full-time work, good wages, good benefits. We're representing that, and we're in full support of this project.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jones, just a quick question. I don't know if this would make sense or not, but is it fair to compare a city of Rochester size to a city of Cleveland size when we talk about this?
Well, it depends on how you want to compare it, in my opinion. One of the problems that we have is we don't have the population and that base. The other thing is we don't have the diversity that larger cities have, like a Boston or a Cleveland. And what I mean by this is we have about 5,500 hotel rooms in which it takes to serve our patient population that comes in. That's an interesting business model. It really exists on a Sunday through Wednesday or Thursday cycle. Businesses can't operate on a four-day week. And I will tell you that Mayo Clinic is getting much better at what they do, and they're doing it much more efficient. They have to in the healthcare world. So we've gone from almost 4.5 nights per visit to about 2.5 nights per visit, just because of efficiencies. We're seeing more patients and more volume, and we expect that to actually double if you read the DMC projections. So that actually creates a bigger challenge. We need to diversify, and we need to bring in incremental business, like corporate business, groups, conventions, sports business, that type of thing, to really fill those businesses on the off-peak days. Otherwise, our people don't work, and our business model doesn't work. So that these two things really go hand in hand in developing the infrastructure that it takes and diversifying that. So that's the difference really between the markets as we see it.
But my question is kind of more about would you really get the conventions that are going to go to Boston or to Cleveland as opposed to Rochester because of the economies of scale, I guess. And maybe that's in your document here that you've already proven that out. But
Mr. Chair, can I just comment? You may be surprised because, honestly, I am surprised sometimes, even walking through a city that I've lived in a long time. The number of organizations, I'll call it medical organizations, because of Mayo and because of the Mayo physician leadership in many cases runs these organizations, the number of offices in town from the society of this or that or the other thing that really, frankly, headquartered in Rochester. And so I think in many cases, yes, we have an edge on this medical convention traffic. It's a huge thing, and by virtue of the fact that we've got a number of offices in Rochester and we've got beyond that, a number of Mayo physicians who lead organizations, not unlike leading any other kind of association. It's quite possible, and I think, as Mr. Jones has pointed out, it's very likely he's turned away $85 million worth of these things already. So we can compete.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jones, the $85 million, I'm just curious. You say you've turned it away. I'm assuming it's because they don't think the facilities are adequate and they go elsewhere. Or is it that you've had other conventions there and you just haven't had enough space to handle these? How do you know for sure they would have come here otherwise? If you could just kind of give me a little more rounding on that issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a great question. We've talked and gone through the proposal phase for that number that we talk about, $85 million. And it's a varying case, some of which could fit and didn't because of the type of space that we have. We have to take, as Senator Senjum mentioned, we have to take an arena space and try to create a ballroom atmosphere out of that. And it doesn't work very well. The other side of that is we may have a small event which takes up half of our center now, so consequently we don't have enough space. We have to sell the dates to somebody else. This project is actually designed so we could have multiple events in at the same time that could coexist, and right now that's just not an option. So specifically, we've talked to them. We've gone through the proposal phase. We know why they aren't coming, and the biggest reason, I would say 70% to 80%, is we don't have a convention center today. We have a civic center. We don't have a convention center.
So, Mr. Chair, a follow-up to that. So will this proposal also accommodate the arena needs? How do those two interchange? If an arena doesn't work for the ballroom setting, is this going to be able to accommodate both, or are you going to turn away some arena conventions because of it?
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are a few upgrades to the arena included in this, not very many, and that's really not the focus of this. The arena runs at a very good clip. We have a lot of events in there, and this is meant to really complement that. A convention really wouldn't use the arena space, but currently today, a convention has to take that arena space, so therefore we deny concerts and community sporting events. If there's a convention, we have to take that space. With this expansion, convention activity would stay in the convention center. Civic and sports activities and arts and culture would stay in that space.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up question to you with regards to Cleveland and Boston being a comparison. Did I not hear, maybe it was Mr. Jones, talk about what's going on right now? Was there a $500 million renovation or project going on in one of those cities compared to this, a more modest one?
Mr. Jones.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator. If you'll look, it's the Cleveland Medical Mart. The county gave that project $460 million of public money. I'm sure that there's other monies associated with it. It's 1 million square feet. This is much smaller, much more modest, really what we need. You know, one of our value propositions to these groups are our room rates in Rochester are much lower. The rental fees at our center would be much lower. Therefore, we would win more of those opportunities, as I talked about. So it's their plans are a little bit different. They're teaming with some partners, and they're doing a medical mart and 1 million square foot, which is enormous. If you look at conventions, we've seen a swing, and they no longer want huge, vast exhibit halls. What they really want is areas for banquets, higher-end space, high technology, and tabletop-type exhibits rather than hauling in these huge 20 by 30 and 30 by 30 exhibits. So we see exhibit halls going away and higher-end-type ballroom space being utilized, in which we're building. So we're kind of building for the future rather than large exhibit hall space.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? You, Do you have one more testifier?
I don't think so. No.
I was hoping you did because I wanted to find out if Mr. Wade was related to the Wades that have Wade Stadium. Okay, all right, good. All right, good. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just to that last point, Mr. Jones, do you have any private markets down there that have ballroom facilities with the hotels, and are you competing with them if we build a government-funded facility? And I think of my hometown area, or my area, not hometown area, but my close to hometown, Alexandria, and we've got some new ballrooms facilities that have built or expanded, and one of the tensions is if a government center would come in and build a new convention center, it would take away some of that market. So can you explain a little of that tension, and I guess this could be relevant to St. Cloud, or don't you have that kind of private investment with the hotels in your area such that it wouldn't be competition?
Mr. Chair, Senator, great question. We have 100% support on this from our hotels. We do have five properties who have ballrooms in their property, but they're much smaller. They're very limited. They hold 200 or less people. And these are designed for what we call citywide events that have citywide impact. Many of those ballrooms would be used by the same events as they go back to their place of lodging. They have evening receptions and things within the hotels. But there is no hotel in Rochester prepared to build the type of space that's required to get these type of convention. It's simply they can't do it. They don't have the property. They don't have the footprint to do it. So we have full support. It's a good question. In some towns, hotels have very, very large ballrooms. Ours do not. They're small ballroom space, and they're occupied now to the point of probably 70% occupancy at this point. So they have weddings and other type of events in their properties.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it, and hopefully we get it done this time. We'll lay over Senate File 342 for possible inclusion in the recommendation to the Bonding Committee. Speaking of the Bonding Committee, Senator Stump, are you here?
Yeah. It's going to be a close vote.
maybe you guys can ask all kinds of questions now. Yeah. Senator Stump, Senate File 1202. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is obviously one of the most busy committees in terms of bonding. I think. When I look over the list, it probably has between a third and a half of all of the bonding proposals that that have been introduced.
I'm thinking Thomas Oney should be on the conference committee. I'm just a suggestion.
Very good idea. members, I, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1202 is a request for some help to extend the sewer, water, electric, and some of the road, city roads for Thief River Falls to a new area of the, kind of right on the edge of the south edge of the of Thief River Falls, where Sanford Healthcare is going to build, or in the they've already started building a $60 million healthcare center. The reason they're doing that is that they purchased the hospital, the Thief River Falls Hospital, which was a community-owned hospital, which was in very old and condition, and not. It was right downtown, and it was not a very conducive facility. It was extremely inefficient energy-wise and had a lot of problems with the structure. And they also purchased the clinic on the, which would be on the kind of the southeast side of town. and they moved the whole new facility, and I believe they're in the handout. You'll see the last page has a picture of the new facility, which will be a combination of both the hospital and the clinic. And what has happened is that this is really an area that has not had water, sewer, or electric, because it's really basically farmland that on the edge of town that they are purchased and developed. So the city has to provide these infrastructure services, and as the I think it was the third or fourth page where it has the kind of a breakdown of the different costs for the sewer, the road, the electric, and it comes to about $3 million. There's been a lot of activity in Thief River Falls. Thief River Falls has had several manufacturers that have grown relatively rapidly in the last few years. Articat is one of them, and DigiKey is a company that has grown as well. And so as this new development occurs in communities, it also puts a huge burden on the infrastructure of the city. And so the total cost of the project, of what they need to do, is a little over $3 million. And what we're asking for in terms of help is about $1.9 million. The services that I think will be the end result will be new kinds of services that are currently not offered, such as kidney dialysis, which is not now. I think currently they have to travel quite a distance to do that, and a host of other new services that will help the medical health care in that area. They also have, I think, probably will develop a connection, a better connection with the surrounding area. Currently, they attract patients from almost the Canadian border on down to, I'd say, roughly, you know, Highway 2, which is quite an area, and then east and west goes from about Beltrami Island, which is where the about where Roseau County, the eastern part of Roseau County, all the way out to North Dakota. They do have good health care services in Bemidji, but from Thief River to Bemidji is somewhat over 100 miles. And then they have pretty good, well, they have excellent health care support over in Grand Forks. And so those are kind of the main areas from, you know, for services in that area. So those are pretty much the information. There's a list of some of the things that are provided or will be provided. And to give you a little bit of a perspective, from here to Thief River is about a little over 325 miles. So it's up in the northwest corner. And
you can't get there from here either.
Pardon?
You can't get there from here either.
It would be an awful long ambulance ride.
Senator Stump, that area you described was about 150 miles square, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
So it's a huge area. And you mentioned DigiKey. DigiKey just had an advertisement in the Duluth paper about a quarter of a page saying that they need people. So it's pretty interesting that they're advertising that far away.
One of the characteristics in that area, and that's becoming more prevalent down here, is that every paper and all the media, they're advertising to hire people. and it's been going on steady. This proposal does increase, it creates about 210 jobs, new jobs. Some of them are a result of the new services that they're going to offer. Some of them are a result of, you know, just a larger facility. So what has happened over the last number of years is that a lot of people in that area have, you know, gone out to North Dakota. They're working in the oil fields. And the pressure on new employees is dramatic. And so there's a shortage of housing because of the growth of the companies and the growth of the businesses up there. And there is also a shortage of employees.
Okay. Any questions of Senator Stumpf? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you, Senator Stumpf. We'll lay this over for it might be in my recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and look forward to your recommendation.
Okay, I appreciate it. Senator Eakin. Welcome to the committee, Senator Eakin. Senator File 703.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Senate File 703 seeks state general obligation bonds to provide funding for wastewater infrastructure improvements all across the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Public Facilities Authority operate the wastewater infrastructure program. We have communities across the state whose wastewater infrastructure needs improvement. We have worked hard over the years to include a bonding request for this program each year. There's a substantial backlog of projects which exceeds $600 million. With every bonding bill that we approve, we are able to work down the list of these projects to meet community needs. Without these state funds, communities would find themselves limited in their wastewater capacity, and we would see constraints on the ability to grow for many of these communities. I understand that the Public Facilities Authority believes that the amounts that they are able to process through the program in any given year may be about $25 million. They're amenable to alterations in the request here, but we certainly want to make sure that there's enough to meet the needs that currently exist and for those projects that are ready to go. With that, I do have with me today Marianne Boren, who is the executive director of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, who supports this bonding request. And after Ms. Boren speaks, we'd be pleased to respond to any questions that you may have.
Well, so. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Boren. Just say your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Marianne Boren, and I'm the executive director of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. The Wastewater Infrastructure Fund has been vital for the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District to move forward on critical infrastructure projects. We do operate a waste treatment facility that serves a 540 square mile radius in the area around Lake Superior in the Duluth area. We have 17 major customers, including the City of Duluth, the Sappy Paper Mill, the City of Cloquet, Scanlon, and the majority of the North Shore. In the 1970s, when the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District and the majority of the wastewater infrastructure in the state of Minnesota was created under the Clean Water Act, there was significant funding that came from a federal and state standpoint to put these facilities in place. The Western Lake Superior Sanitary District in and of itself has an asset replacement value of about $500 million should that facility have to be rebuilt. Unfortunately, I can attest, because Friday is my 50th birthday, and our wastewater infrastructure is approaching much the same age, that things don't work quite as well after 50 years.
You look way better than your
infrastructure. Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator. But as we're looking at our aging infrastructure, unfortunately, as is the case with much of our infrastructure, be it bridges or roads, the investment in keeping the infrastructure we spent so much money and so much effort building in the first place up to date has been sorely lacking. the state of Minnesota has provided quite a service for not only our facility but other facilities in the state in funding wastewater infrastructure. I think one of the questions is why this year? Why in a non-bonding year? And I just would like to point out that last year there was approximately $15 million put in the wastewater infrastructure fund last bonding year, with five of those $15 million allocated, specifically earmarked for a project. That only left 10. $10 million, when you look at a $600 million-plus backlog of projects, is not enough to cover the needs in 1 year, much less two bonding years. For us, as just an example of one entity of many in the state, we have a project in one of our major infrastructure lines, one of the lines that convey all of the effluent from the city of Cloquet and Scanlon and the Sappy paper mill, that has a major defect. That particular project is on the 2013 intended use plan. It has enough points that it will get WIF funding if there is money put in the bonding bill this year. If there's not, we still will need to move forward. And as a public infrastructure, you never want to be making those choices between what do you need to do from the environment and the viability of your infrastructure balance to what can your ratepayers afford. So we do request that the committee take action on this and that there be money put in if there is a bonding bill in 2013, that it does include money for wastewater infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of either the senator or the witness? This is one of those areas where we never put enough money into it, and we always need more. And I think this is a good number to start out with. So I appreciate it. Anybody have any other comments? If not, then we'll lay over Senate File 703 for possible inclusion and recommendation of the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Senator Dibble, why don't you go up next? You're pinch hitting for Senator Champion on one of them, so you decide which one you want to do first, okay?
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I will put on my Senator Champion hat first. And let my, I think, is this the fourth mayor to appear in front of the committee?
It's a good crew.
All right.
Not for much longer, though. Huh?
I got plenty of time. It wouldn't count me out.
Not quite the lame duck. Mr. Chair, members, I have before us Senate File 192, which would provide $25 million for a Phase 1 renovation of Nicollet Mall in downtown Minneapolis. And just very briefly, I'll just speak very briefly to the bill because, of course, we have the mayor and the council president here and a couple of community members who can speak to why this is a good idea. But the short version is that Nicollet Mall is a vital and vibrant business corridor through the heart of the largest downtown in our state. It's often been called Minnesota's Main Street. Adjacent or nearby, you know, we have tens of thousands of jobs. 140,000 workers travel to this corridor or near this corridor every day to work. There are 34 million feet of office space. The Nicollet Mall has really served as a catalyst for the development, redevelopment, and vitalization of downtown Minneapolis. The rehab itself would, of course, represent a tremendous number of jobs in and of itself. As you know, it was built quite a while ago. It was, you know, Nicollet Avenue turned into the Nicollet Mall back when I was first born. And since that time has received, you know, a little bit of remodeling, but it received a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean,
you
there
look
are
better than the infrastructure too.
Tremendous amount of pressure. So it's really showing its age, and it's really becoming less functional for the purpose in which it serves. You know, the opportunity to create transit opportunities, downtown business and retail, the hotels, the entertainment districts that are nearby. And one thing that folks may be aware of, but some interestingly aren't, is the level of residential amenity that's downtown. How many people live downtown, and how many how much downtown really is a residential area, and it's a real hallmark, and it creates the kind of vitality that really benefits the region and the state as well. And this will generate a tremendous amount of associated private investment. You have the flyers in front of you. It's anticipated that $2.7 billion in private investment would be spurred by this revitalization of Nicollet Mall. With that, I'll stop talking. I'm guessing some of these facts and points will be repeated, but help round out the vision for the Nicollet Mall with Mayor Ryback and Council President Johnson.
Thank you very much, Senator, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. It's great to be here and follow my fellow colleagues, some good mayors in the state. We've heard some great history today, and let me
say,
do...
Say your name for the record, Mayor.
I'm sorry, R.T. Ryback. I'm the mayor of Minneapolis for about 272 more days, and I'm counting, believe me. I will be here. So,
you're not going to Florida or anything, are you?
On a mayor's salary, you can get maybe to Albert Lea, but I don't need Florida. I'm really honored today. And let me, if I could, put some historic perspective. And there's nothing, Mr. Chair, wrong with Albert Lea. It's a fantastic place to go.
Yeah, you do need that vote, too.
Although, Mr. Chairman, there are many great parts of this state. It's great to be here. The history
are you running for governor or what?
Yeah, no, I got it up on my hand.
I'd like an answer to that question.
We're all looking forward to it.
I said, well, telling history, not making it yet. So let's start at the beginning. You know, we've talked a lot about history today, and it's a good part. The very quick history, and Nicollet Mall is a very good story for this state. It was a strong retail street. My parents met when my dad was running the Walgreens at 9th and Nicollet. It was doing fine. But cities across America were changing very radically in the 60s. The suburban shopping malls were being built, and one downtown after the other fell apart. Detroit, Cleveland, name them, really fell apart, and Minneapolis chose to do something different. The business leaders of Minneapolis stood up and said, we can't have just a normal street as the main street of the state of Minnesota. What we've really got to do is to have a public-private partnership that brings this to a whole new level. And the theory was, if in the era when cities were being hollowed out, the city of Minneapolis stood up and said, we're going to create something that's a destination, that has higher amenities than a traditional street, that we'd do a couple things. We'd keep the downtown strong, we'd keep the retail strong, and we'd also make it a place where both offices and residential would locate. So that was a theory back in the 60s. How did it work? Well, it worked incredibly well. Downtown Minneapolis stayed one of the strongest downtowns in the country, but this also became a street that helped us keep our corporate headquarters and keep jobs here. Stop and look at the evolution of Dayton's into Target and keeping that headquarters downtown and in the middle of the city. Look at U.S. Bank, now the fifth largest bank in the United States of America. Look at Dane, Piper, and go up and down that street, and the theory worked. Retail as well. But more important, what it did is it saved a tremendous amount of other costs that other cities are doing trying to figure out how to, quote, unquote, save their downtown. The Nicollet Mall worked, but that was 1967. And today, after many, many years, including one renovation that was, again, privately financed by the private sector, it's time to redo the street. We start with the idea that the private sector is again stepping up and putting $15 million on the table as part of a renovation that we believe can move this dramatically forward. We're requesting that the state match that with $25 million so we can once again create a street that is a major destination. It's absolutely clear that cities need to take care of their streets, and Minneapolis does that. We're in the middle of one of the largest paving programs we've had in the city of Minneapolis, and we should continue to do that. But as we look to the idea of how to take this hallmark street and really make sure that it moves us into the next few decades and does the same, we have to have a partnership here. The goal is to do a $40 million renovation of this street with that $15 million in private funds and completely rebuild it. There are physical needs in the street. It's unfortunately falling apart on many levels, the curbs and gutters, and even some of the underpinning under the street needs to be rebuilt. But we also need to think, what is the real catalyst for downtowns that they have around the country? So that's what our effort is today. I'm here with our council president, Mark Stenglein, from our downtown council, and one of our top retail leaders is also here as well. And we're obviously here to answer questions.
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barbara Johnson, Minneapolis City Council President. I appreciate the chance to speak to you today, and I just have to say I have so enjoyed listening to all the presentations, and it just tells us as we listen to these things what a wonderful, diverse economy we have as a state. And this project is really the center place of that diverse economy. It is a marvelous place. As Senator Dibble said, it's a place where we have many residents. We are ahead of our projections in our downtown residents. We now have about 33,000 people that live in our downtown. 140,000 people visit come to work in our downtown every day, just feathered out from that Nicollet Mall. And this improvement, this reconstruction of this existing project supports the economy, the tremendous $1 billion hospitality industry we have in the state. It ties us to our convention center and brings people to our riverfront. So I would encourage you to look at this project today and understand the significance of it for Minneapolis, but also for the rest of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, I know this isn't your bill, but in the handout you have here, that you comment that the request of $25 million will leverage $25 million in public and private investment, but it's not in the language of the bill. Is it the intent that state money would match private money? And maybe that's a question for the mayor. I don't know.
And I think it's $15 million, Mr. Chair, that we're in, that the private sector is coming forward with.
Okay, we can do this at another time, but
right.
It says 25 in your hand of flyer.
Oh, it says 25.
So I'm just, once it gets toward the bonding committee, maybe we can have a matching language, and I'd rather do it with the, you know, the chief author of the bill here, so I'm not going
right. Well, I'll alert. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll alert Senator Champion about the idea to do it.
Do you have some more testifiers?
Yes, we have Mr. Stengline, former county commissioner, but now executive director of the Minneapolis Downtown Council.
Is that a raise?
Well, Mr. Chair, not really. Just a different hat, I guess. Mr. Chair, Mark Stengline, president of the Minneapolis Downtown Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I will be with you briefly because I know you've got a lot on your table today. I'm also joined by a business owner along the mall. The Minneapolis Downtown Council, as many of you know, is the oldest downtown business association in the country. And the Downtown Council plans on 15-year increments. We're presently in our 2025 plan. And one of the main tenets of that plan is a revitalized Nicollet Mall to tie the Walker into the river by way of the mall. And as a bit of history, and we touched a lot on history today. It's been 41 years since Mary Tyler Moore threw her hat in the air at 7th and Nicollet. So it's been there a while, and it's served it quite well. And as you've heard today, the amount of pressure of over 140,000 people touching it daily does take its toll, even on Mary Tyler Moore. And she's still there in a statue form, by the way. But I can't tell you the number of times when I walk down the mall, and I do it daily, the number of folks from across the state that will get their picture taken by that statue. So without further ado, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to a current business owner who's sitting with us today as well. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Jost, President and CEO of J.P. Hudson Jewelers, and I have a really simple message. I simply love Nicollet Mall. Even though it's tarnished now, after the implementation of the 2025 plan, it's going to sparkle back to her glory. J.B. Hudson has been located on Nicollet Mall since 1885. That's a big bit of history. And just think of the amount of taxes we've paid over that time period. We desperately need Nicollet Mall to continue to be the vibrant and compelling place that supports not only our customers, employees, but also the residents. We will just not attract key business leaders unless we make huge improvements to Nicollet Mall. The 2025 plan really addresses every issue. It addresses everything from housing to transit. Without a safe pedestrian environment, my customers will simply go elsewhere. So I am speaking here because I desperately need it. I have put my stake in the ground. Your investment in this plan is really crucial to Nicollet Mall and the downtown community. We need really to compete with other cities, and this is where we will be able to do that. I have a lot of messages from all of my friends and business leaders in the downtown community, and I just want to read just a couple of them to reinforce how...
You're not allowed to do them all.
No, I promise. Just two, okay?
Who's good?
Okay. this is from Elliot Jaffe, President of Commercial Banking for U.S. Bank. With nearly 3,000 employees, that's a lot of employees, in downtown Minneapolis, located on Nicollet Mall, we believe that Nicollet Mall is the heart of our central business district, and I join other business leaders supporting the governor's bonding recommendation for this very important regional asset. Mike Davis from General Mills, a strong and vibrant community is key to our recruitment of talented future leaders who will help continue the growth of General Mills. Now, this is from General Mills, not even located in downtown Minneapolis. One more. John Griffith, CEO of Target. Nicollet Mall is more than just a street. It's a community hub. And I just want to thank you so much for letting me speak my passion. We just really need this Nicollet Mall bonding, and we'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? How many people does Target employ downtown?
Oh, gosh.
Around 7,200 total.
Downtown?
Well, I mean, throughout their whole system.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you all very much. We'll lay Senate File 192 over for a possible inclusion and a recommendation to the bonding committee. Senator Dibble, you have now Senate File 1000.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I have Senate File 1000, which would, at long last, if we're successful, revitalize and renovate the Walker Sculpture Garden. I'll try to be very, very brief. The Walker Sculpture Garden, Mr. Chair and members, was, and I don't know if folks know this, was the first major sculpture garden of its type in the country, and for many years was the crown jewel, and many sculpture gardens that have cropped up since then really came to the Walker to learn how to do this. Millennial Park, of course, in Chicago is probably the other one that's best known, but there are a number of others around the country that have sprung up since then. It, of course, is a result of a partnership between the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, which owns the property, the land on which the sculpture garden sits, and then the programming and the installations that are owned, of course, by the Walker. The art in the park, the initial outlay effort by the private sector was $16 million. That included building the sculpture garden and acquiring all the art and commissioning the art, et cetera. The art alone itself has grown in value since that time to $55 million. Thousands and thousands of people from across the state come to the sculpture garden every year. Many of those are young people. More than a quarter of those are young people. We know that the Spoon Bridge and Cherry has become an icon of Minneapolis and of Minnesota, we know that there's a tremendous amount of programming as well that goes on. And all of this, Mr. Chair, members, is free to the public, open to the public. This is one of the major cultural institutions that has not asked for bonding money. The sculpture garden itself, like the Nicollet Mall, is worn out. It's 25 years old, and if you've visited it recently, it looks pretty bad. It's got a lot of functional problems. It's worn out. It's getting pretty threadbare. The soil itself has gotten to be pretty bad. It's kind of a lower lying area. A lot of problems with the groundwater. It's in an old ancient riverbed. Dealing with drainage, et cetera, has been a big problem. The vision for this is to really update it, revitalize it, and use some of the most current and sound environmental practices to deal with the water in the area. And we'll describe that a little bit more in some of the testimonies. With that, I will suspend. And if you want to
Sure.
We have Olga Vizo, who's the executive director of the Walker Center.
Nice to see you again. Welcome
nice
to the committee.
Nice to see you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Olga Vizo, executive director at the Walker Arts Center, and I'm actually joined by Jennifer Ringgold from the Parks and Recreation Board, and I actually have sitting behind me two board members from the Walker, Roger Hale and Judy Dayton, who were very involved in the founding of
that,
the garden.
Is that Auntie Dayton?
Pardon, Judy Dayton.
Is that Auntie Dayton?
Yes, it is.
And so we are here with a request to you for $7 million to renovate really one of the incredible assets of our state, really an iconic destination that after 25 years of very intensive public use is in disrepair and is in need of, it has failing infrastructure that really is at the point that it needs to be addressed. And since we opened in 1988, we've welcomed over 8 million visitors to the garden, and that's about 350,000 visitors a year. As Senator Dibble mentioned, the Oldenburg Spoonbridge and Cherry is really one of the most beloved icons of the state. It's one of the most tagged photo sites when you Google the state of Minnesota. It's on many Minnesota guidebooks, and as Senator Dibble mentioned, it is free 365 days of the year. 31% of those visitors come from outside of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. 26% of them are children, and of those 26% of kids under 18, 70% come from outside the 11-county area. Again, free 365 days of the year, and of many of the art projects that have come before the legislature through the years, this is really the only one that is completely free to the public. And for 25 years, as mentioned, the Minneapolis Sculpture Garden has been a partnership of the Walker Arts Center and the Parks and Recreation Board. And it really was the first urban sculpture park of its kind, was recognized as so, and not only in terms of its design of bringing art in the public realm and bringing art and culture and environment together, but also because it was a model example and really one of the first ones of public-private partnership. And that has been emulated by many cities around the country, most notably in Chicago, but also Seattle and Dallas. And all parks that have come and sent delegations to study and understand not just the design and its use, but also its the kind of partnership that is there. And it took tens of millions of dollars to create those sculpture parks in recent years. And what we're coming to you is a relatively small investment of $7 million to ensure that it remains an icon and a landmark for another generation. So I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Ringgold to talk a little bit more specifically about the infrastructure upgrades.
Thank you, Ms. Ringgold.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Jennifer Ringgold, and I'm the Strategic Planning Director for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. What we are really looking for here is not about the art infrastructure, but the infrastructure of the park itself that supports the art. So this isn't about funding the art. This is about supporting what supports the art within the park. So as we look forward to improving the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure there, we look forward with also changing our approach because we want this to become more sustainable, easier to maintain, and we want to be able to apply more up-to-date, not 25-year-old, but current technology in order to do that. And there are a few key areas that are perhaps most noteworthy, and one of them in particular has caught the attention of the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization. So as Senator Dibble had explained, there are considerable water issues within this site. If you look at one of the images on the one pager, you will see a pond. And it might be hard to tell the difference between where the grass starts and where the pond begins because the pond is equally as green, if not more. So there are significant issues with water quality as well as drainage and managing the stormwater in this site. So the MWMO, or the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization, is looking at contributing up to $1.5 million towards this project. They see this as an opportunity to not only improve the water quality and the stormwater elements of this, but also to showcase in a very public 300 visits or more a year way how some of these stormwater treatments can be useful in this type of a public setting. So that's one example. The other example is the Coles Conservancy. I'm sure maybe when you were at one time walking over to the Guthrie, you might have walked through it. Beautiful building, and the building itself is still in very good condition. The initial purpose of that building varies quite a bit to what we would need that building to do today. So when we look at that building, we think about not only improving the mechanicals and the infrastructure of that building, kind of the nuts and bolts of it, but we also look at repurposing that building to a more sustainable use. And our goal on that would be to actually reduce the operating cost of that building down to one-third of its current operating cost. So if you think about us contributing between the Walker and the Park Board, nearly $600,000 a year towards the operation of the entire area, we'd really be looking at trying to take some of those most costly measures, whether it's the irrigation or whether it's the actual maintaining of that building, that operating that building, and reducing those costs so that we could not only have a better facility to offer people, but have one that's more sustainable for us to operate long term. We are asking for both design and construction dollars. Our hope would be, if funded, that we'd look forward to design and planning this fall and construction next year. Based on numbers that we see coming out of the National Park and Recreation Association, we figure that at $50,000 per job, we'd be able to generate about 170 jobs through this construction process. And again, this would be the first time that state money would go into protecting, preserving, and maintaining this icon.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, it seems to me we passed $2 million for this project in 2010, but it got vetoed by the governor. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We've been before the legislature several times. Have yet to receive $1 for this purpose.
So you said design and engineering. Is pre-design necessary also, or is that all set to go?
No, we would go right into design and then into the construction component.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the reasons I joined the committee on bonding is so I can get around and look at all the beautiful things we have in the state that I haven't seen from I-94 on a boat. So I'm really looking forward to touring these should they move forward. But one of the questions I do have here is, and one might expect that coming from me, have you asked for any funding at all through Metro Parks, either this year, or would you consider doing that should bonding not be a successful endeavor for you, as well as in 2010? I guess I don't remember that particular time when it was line item veto, but I know the parks funding through legacy money was going on then. Has there been any effort at all for that?
Ms. Ringel can answer that question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question, Chair and committee members. This park is not eligible for regional park funding because it technically is not a regional park within the regional park designation. So it would need to become a regional park, and then it would need to compete for regional park funding within that designation. So no, we have not asked for regional park funding, nor is it eligible for the Parks and Trails dollars either.
Is that because of the criteria that's set forward to get regional park funding?
Chair and committee, correct. This does not meet the stated criteria for a regional park.
Do you think we should eliminate that criteria?
I think the criteria has value.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's the, I mean, there's a lot of visitors there, but the park for the Metro Parks, I believe the square footage is a large square footage, and this is a very small contained area, so it's the square footage. But it does get a lot of visitors, and a lot of visitors from out of the metro area.
Who was the sculptor of that cherry, anyway?
Klaus Oldenburg. And so we're gearing up for the 25th anniversary celebration. It actually turns 25 in September. And Klaus Oldenburg is coming back. We're doing a big exhibition survey of his career. So it'll be a big celebratory moment, a tremendous amount of programming and new sculpture that will go into the garden.
But nice. Okay. Thank you. Then, Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, heard it referenced a few times, 25 years. To me, that doesn't seem like a real long time. Is there a reason it's not weathered longer than this, or what do you expect the future of
Mr.
this
Chair,
project to be? I mean, 25 years is kind of a short lifetime, and is there something unique with this design, or how long would this new renovation last.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, a couple of responses, and I'll turn it over to my witnesses. But 25, I disagree slightly with the characterization. That to me is a long time, especially when you consider the amount of pressure that this park receives and the number of visitors. A lot of people mm-hmm. moving through, and you know the plant material, the hardscape, the and the nature of the area. You know, it's kind of a low lying. I won't say wetland, but it approaches a wetland. It's in this lower basin, ancient riverbed. The water management issues are pretty difficult to manage, and that of course also contributes to the deterioration. And this is actually, when you think about it, $7 million after 25 years of very intensive use, is not a lot.
So, do you expect the renovation to probably last about 25 years? I mean, I graduated just about 25 years ago, and it doesn't seem like that long ago.
You're holding up pretty good, too.
I graduated 30 years ago. It seems like a long time ago. Yeah. So just wait for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. One of you.
I don't know how long it's going to last.
Ms. Wiesel, Ms. Ringel.
Do you want to venture?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair, Committee. 25 years for this type of hardscape, if you think of how frequently maybe a sidewalk in front of your home would need to be replaced, or vegetation and materials or irrigation systems within even your community might need to be replaced. It's a little early, but not outstandingly early. What we would look at here, though, is actually learning from the practices the first time through and making sure that this time we'd be able to, with some of the new technologies available, better accommodate the soils and have a better understanding of how much wear and tear this facility is going to get, so that we would learn from the previous scenario moving forward and be able to for sure hit 25, if not 30 years for this type of improvement.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wiesel has.
And I just wanted to add also, too, that just because the garden also sits amidst a kind of net of highways, there's the pollution, salt, all that has put stress, obviously, on the plant material. So that's another reason why we're seeing that. And a number of the upgrades are also related to lighting, security, and accessibility. Standards are different today than they were at that time, and so those upgrades are also very much a part of, you know,
You have pollution now here?
You have some pollution. And soil compaction, again, from so much use.
Mr. Chair, it's right in the crook there of the Lindale-Hennepin Commons,
I've
94 and 394. It's
Senator
pretty intensive. Britson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I still have to follow up with the idea of it being beneficial to you to be long to the Metro Parks system. Would it be beneficial or not? I guess would be the question. 11 acres, and I'm looking at the presentation, 11 acre park is small in comparison to some, but I know very, very large in comparison to some of the regional ones in Metro, actually, too, or excuse me, rural. So I'm just wondering, would it still not be beneficial to belong or to qualify for those dollars?
Chair, committee, members, I would say that certainly being a part of the Metro system makes this amenity able to compete for other funding within the Metro system. It would probably have to be some type of a special, one of the special parks like some of the ones that Three Rivers and others have. Understanding that as this would tap into the funding within that area, it would mean that other parks might not be funded to the same level. So there's a cost and benefit to that type of decision that would need to be really thought about and clearly considered before putting it into that type of a scenario.
So, Mr. Chair, just for the committee's information, we just confirmed the minimum space criteria now, other than perhaps for some of these special exceptions, is typically 100 acres. So this would be a fairly unique and special case if we were to try to get into that pool and compete for that pot of dollars. But to answer your question more directly, Senator Ingebrigtsen, sure, we'll take any money anywhere. But but that's a lengthy process that has no certain outcome.
And Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, you said 100 acres is the minimum? Okay.
Those are self-imposed regulations, by the way. But anyway, okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, okay, I don't know if we want to get into that discussion,
not on this bill. Okay, so we'll lay Senate File 1000 over for possible inclusion in the recommendations of the Bonding Committee. Thank you all very much. Senator Schmidt, you got three bills. Why don't you go next? I'm really impressed with the committee today. We should be on TV more often. You guys are all sticking around through the whole thing.
We're on TV.
There's not much you can do with that, is there? Really?
I hope they caught that. Which bill are you going to do, Senator Schmidt?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. If we could, in the interest of time for the committee, maybe we could consider Senate Files 578 and 579 concurrently.
Okay.
They're two separate bills, but I think they speak to one vision for Red Wing, and that's the Red Wing River Renaissance. And I'm very pleased to be with you here today to talk about these projects. And we've heard a lot of good testimony today and a lot of deserving projects. I'll try to be as proficient as Senator Reiner and get through three of them real quick here. But the Red Wing River Renaissance has two components to it. One is an upgrade of the Sheldon Theater. It's over 100 years old in the heart of downtown Red Wing. And I can remember being a kid going to shows there. And it's a huge community asset. It's a big draw. It's an anchor for downtown Red Wing. But it's old, and it hasn't had significant improvements for almost 25 years. What we're asking for is for approximately $700,000 for upgrades for plumbing and restroom to make them ADA compliant, to upgrade and replace the HVAC system, and also to get the 21st century ticketing and stage equipment in place. Again, this is a huge draw for Red Wing. We have over 100 shows a year, 20,000 people coming into Red Wing to spend money. The average Red Wing resident spends $30 per event night in addition to the ticket. And folks coming in from out of town spend approximately $45 per person in addition to the ticket. And being, of course, on the river and next to Wisconsin, we love to take money from our neighbors to the east. So this is a big draw. Brings folks in to stimulate our local economy, and it's a huge part of the vision for keeping a downtown Red Wing economy vibrant in the years ahead. The second part of this project is the Levee Road reconstruction right on the river in downtown Red Wing, and we're asking for approximately $1.5 million to upgrade the road itself. We have retaining walls that are falling over, and we have kind of a dangerous situation in which we have a lot of bike and pedestrian traffic with regular traffic and also some commercial traffic all in one area. It's a big draw. It's a destination in and of itself, but there's a lot going on down here, and we want to make sure that we're investing to make this safe. We also have a Riverwalk Trail that's a component of this, and also an upgrade to a small boat harbor all along the levee here. This is a front door or an access to Red Wing for a lot of boat traffic in the summer. The American Queen riverboat comes down on several occasions throughout the course of the summer, and we want to make it easier for folks to visit Red Wing, not only in their cars, but in their boats. And this is a way of opening that front door and allowing them into our communities. I guess with that said, we have some great testimony here. I'd like to conclude mine and allow Councilmember Rader to speak.
Okay, go ahead. Who's wants
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peggy Rader, a member of the Red Wing City Council and the council's liaison to the T.B. Sheldon Board of Trustees. We'd like to thank the chair and the committee for hearing these two shovel-ready projects that make up the Red Wing River Renaissance, the Levee Road construction and the Sheldon Theater. The entire City Council unanimously supports these projects, which both promote the regional economy as well as recreational and arts opportunities for our community. Both projects will be leveraging other sources of funding in addition to this bonding. With the Levee Road project, the city requests $1.6 million in bonding that matches up with federal, state, and city match. With the Sheldon, the city is asking for $685,000 in bonding to match $741,000 in local, private, and city funding. These two projects also receive support from local business, the Chamber of Commerce, the Visitors and Convention Bureau, recreational groups, and others who have sent letters and messages of support to the governor, the bonding chair, and other legislators. I'm not going to attempt to read any of these because there's quite a number of them. I believe that the members of the committee have received copies of these letters. With me today are Jim Larson, the manager of the Redwing Grain Company, who will be able to tell you more about the Levee Road project, and Mike Melstead, who is the executive director of the YMCA and a member of the Sheldon Board of Trustees. Interestingly enough, the YMCA sits exactly halfway between the river and the Sheldon Theater, that being basically a block in each direction. So Mike has considerable knowledge about the impact of both of these projects. And with that, I'd like to introduce Jim Larson, the manager of Redwing Grain, to speak about their portion of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing us today. Again, my name is Jim Larson. I am the general manager of Redwing Grain, which is located on Levee Road, downtown in Redwing, on the Mississippi River. We strongly support the Redwing River Renaissance Project, and the project is very important. The levee is very important to the economy in Redwing in general. As a whole, we are the only grain terminal that loads grain for export on the river from St. Paul all the way to Winona. Our business is over 60 years old, and we are serving farmers from about 1,500 customers in a local area of about 75-mile radius from Redwing. We ship it down the river, ship it on barges, and it goes down the river for export. We approximately have about $250 million worth of grain that has moved through our terminal last year. This grain is brought in by truck and is loaded into barge on our busy riverfront. If you look at the map, you can see why the region needs the project to get completed. You can see on the back side of the one sheet of the map. And these trucks, approximately in our busy season, is about 250 to 300 semi-trucks a day coming in through our facility, are sharing that road with cars, pedestrians, bicycles, and it does create a safety hazard and can be a real problem at times. The other issue that we run into as a facility is we have a lot of, whenever there's flooding problems and the river gets so high, the one end of the road has to close down, so it limits our access for parking and for unloading trucks and so forth. So this project addresses two main issues again for us: the safety of our employees, customers, and community is our number one. And this project provides long overdue safety improvements, including separating the pedestrian and bicyclists from the large truck traffic that comes into our facility. The second thing is that restructuring the deteriorated portions and of the road, raising the road, and improving the retaining wall will provide help us during when the water rises at times when the road is shut down. So it prevents or helps us out with our customer service to keep us moving during those times. As both a businessman and a citizen of Redwing, I think this project makes good sense. It handles several problems at the same time along the river, and construction disruption is minimized from with that. And the state bonds will match up with local, state, federal money to complete them in a cost-effective manner. So I appreciate your time, and we just hope that you will provide us the funds needed to ensure that our riverfront can continue to be an economic and export engine and for our region in the years to come. I'd like to next introduce Mike Melstead, who's going to talk to you about the riverfront and the Sheldon Theater.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Melstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking time with us today. My name is Mike Melstead. I'm the director of the Redwing Family YMCA. I'm also the treasurer of the Sheldon Theater Board of Trustees, and the Sheldon and Levee Road and the YMCA have shared a very close, compact relationship for more than 100 years. The Red Wing is built on pottery, grain, and shoes, and boots, and they have been hauling grain down the hill to load on barges to take away for 150 years. The snag with all of this is that when they designed that system, the grain was hauled down by horses in wagons, and there was not a tremendous waterfront usage at the time. Right now, we have a mess on Levee Road that consists of Winnebagos with boat trailers behind it, sharing the traffic with ladies with strollers, senior citizens in three-wheeled carts, people walking dogs, grain trucks, assorted tourists milling around. We have a very unsafe situation. Something that the city folks haven't mentioned is also that because of the way the road is laid out and the way the storm sewers are designed, is that when the river reaches a flooding condition, we have to plug up the storm sewers around our $20 million YMCA property at the corner there, because the storm sewers will back right up into our space. So the design was built for another time and another set of uses, and I strongly support correcting this. I think Red Wing Grain has, by offering their property to share for trails and sidewalks, is tremendously generous. That's a very significant offer from a private party for a public use, and I really appreciate it. The Levee Road connection and the trail system is a critical link in connecting the downtown area with that recreational commercial area down by the river. It really is a critical connection. The Sheldon Theater is a major economic driver in town, along with the other arts institutions, with the Anderson Center, with a really vibrant local arts community. And the Sheldon draws in 20,000 to 25,000 people a year, given the season. And half of those people stay in hotels, they eat in restaurants, they shop locally. It's a tremendous economic engine. People come from all over the state, all over Wisconsin, and all over Iowa and the Dakotas as well. We regularly have people in town for a Sheldon production stop at the YMCA and get a tour of the Y, and we show them around town. It's a big economic engine there, has a very large regional impact. And if the local hotel owners or local restaurant owners were sitting here today, they would confirm that for you. The theater desperately needs a rehabilitation. 100 years ago, there was no Americans with Disability Act. There was vastly different standards for theatrical productions. And we need a hand helping bring that facility up to date. The plans are there. We could swing this into operation tomorrow, and we would deeply appreciate your support there. Additionally, I want to point out there's a one-to-one city and private match there. We've done the legwork on the private match, and I'm very sure this is going to happen. It's a tremendous boost to tourism, and it's a tremendous boost to keeping our downtown active and vital in Red Wing. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chair, and we'd take any questions.
Any questions or comments from members? Okay, seeing none, never laid over two at once, but we're going to lay over Senate File 578 and Senate File 579 for possible inclusion in the recommendation of the Bonding Committee. Senator Schmidt, your next bill looks like it has some very technical explanations coming up on it, and I know Senator Rood has some people from Brainerd, and I have some people from the Iron Range. And let's do yours last, okay? Just
no
because
problem.
Because it could be, you know, I think you're going to take a long time on it. I got a funny feeling. I just don't know why. But
I'm going to do my best to be concise, Mr. Chair. But
no,
I understand.
You will, but it could get into some kind of a discussion. So, Senator Rood, why don't you do your bill now?
Oh, okay. Sure. You're doing that, sometimes.
Senator Root, Senate File 1039.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, thank you. We are here before you today for the sewer and water extension for the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. The Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport is a vitally important asset for our region, and it connects us with the rest of the state and the world. And today I have the experts with me here today, and I think we'll start off with...
Certainly.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Wigg. I'm the airport manager for the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Rood, for allowing us to come to visit with you today. I apologize to the committee. We did not bring any visual aids. Since this bill is about sewage, we didn't think it might do something. So we elected to go without. Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport is an increasingly important airport, state service center, and economic development hub for Minnesota. Brainerd Lakes Regional is one of three airports in the state to have two runways over 6,500 feet that are capable of landing large jets. The other two are Rochester and Minneapolis-St. Paul International. In addition to scheduled Delta and SkyWest airline flights, our airport is home to 84 aircraft of various sizes and 12 other businesses and organizations who maintain a base with us and help provide the 50-plus jobs that are on the field. Some of these organizations include the Minnesota Highway Patrol and the Minnesota DNR, which together have five aircraft based on the field, including two helicopters. We also have a major DNR air tanker base on the field that provides fire suppression services to basically the southern two-thirds of the state. And North Memorial Air Care has their only outstate helicopter maintenance base on our field, as well as two critical care transport helicopters. And their base is manned, staffed with EMTs, nurses, and pilots, 24/7 basis. Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport was also fortunate to construct a $7.4 million new airline terminal building that was completed about 14 months ago. That terminal was largely funded by federal grant money, and it provided scores of quality construction jobs during the recent economic recession. The fire suppression system in this building is presently supplied with water from a pre-existing well. When the state fire marshal signed off on the building, it was with the stipulation that we connect our fire suppression system to the city of Brainerd water system by April of 2016. At present, the nearest sewer and water connection is approximately 2.5 miles from the airport property line along State Highway 210 through land that is very lightly developed at this time. This bill, bringing sewer and water connections to the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport, would alleviate numerous issues that the airport faces. The airport currently has a patchwork of nine different standalone septic systems and holding tanks on the field. These systems have had to be expanded and patched as the airport has grown and can freeze out in the winter. In fact, the North Memorial Air Care Base septic system has frozen out in recent years. And since the flight crews and nurses actually live on the facility for 24 hours at a time during their shift, this can force the base to temporarily close, leaving a gap in a life-saving service. Connecting the entire airport to the city septic system would alleviate these maintenance and freeze-out concerns and prevent environmental problems and would eliminate the need to continually dig and expand drain fields and pump holding tanks on the field. Bringing city water connections to the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport would also greatly benefit the field. The various buildings in the airport are currently supported by numerous low-capacity wells that are limited in many aspects, especially, as was mentioned, in regard to the terminal's fire suppression system. One other important water-related challenge involves that DNR air tanker base that's on the east end of the field. Minnesota was very wise a number of years ago to purchase CL-215 fire suppression aircraft. And if you've ever seen those in action, they're just a fun thing to watch. They dip into the water, they can pull water out of the out of area lakes and rivers, and can drop them on fires. The difficult part is before ice out, which I understand is currently scheduled for July 4th, they have to fill these from a hose at the tanker base. And that can be a very slow process. And when I was younger and working at the airport refueling those air tankers, I got to find out how much the pilots dislike delays. As a matter of fact, they taught me some words that are snuck into my lexicon at age 16 I'd never heard before. In addition, our air tanker base has been evaluated for use by C-130 Hercules converted air tankers, as well as converted DC-10 heavy jet water bomber. Both of these aircraft do not have the ability to dip out of lakes and so would need to refill from the limited capacity of the DNR's well. The high-capacity water flow that city service would provide would eliminate that bottleneck and shorten our base's response times to fire. Finally, one other important benefit of this sewer and water connection for Brainerd Lakes Regional and ultimately the region would be the ability to attract high-wage, aviation-related commercial development to the field. Doing so will not only attract high-wage jobs to the region, but it will also generate lease revenue that will help make the airport that much more self-sufficient and help insulate the airport from variations in federal funding, such as we're seeing right now at some airports in the state. Attracting quality commercial development on the field, however, is almost entirely dependent upon having that sewer and water connection to the field. Thank you for considering my testimony, and with the chair's permission, I'll turn it over to Mr. Jeff Hulsether, our city engineer.
Thank you, Mr. Wig. Mr. Hulsether.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. To avoid confusion, Jeff and I, we're going to flip a coin to see which one would change its name to Mutt, but we thought maybe younger members of the committee might not catch that one.
Don't worry, we use Mr. around here for everybody. So you don't have to worry about the Jeff part.
Thank you, sir.
Your name for the record, though, please.
Jeff Hulsether, Brainerd City Engineer.
Okay.
Back in 2006, the City of Brainerd commissioned a master plan for utility extensions in the northeast area of Brainerd. The planning area extended from our existing corporate limits at Lum Park to the airport, which is about 2.5 miles northeast of the city. It's a typical master plan, essentially taking a look at existing land uses and proposed land uses and calculating the required flows to serve not only present but future and proposed developments. There's three distinct land uses that we looked at within the master plan document. First is the airport, to identify what their current flow requirements are for water and sewer. We also consulted their master plan to take a look at the build-out of the airport and the proposed aviation-related development being proposed on that site. The second land use that we took a look at was a lot of existing dense residential development that lies between Brainerd and the airport along Rice Lake and the Mississippi River. Rice Lake is a backwater of the Mississippi River created by the Wausau Dam on the Mississippi River. The development, is quite dense. We have about 250 residential units that predate shoreline management regulations and also predate the 70-80 rules for individual septic treatment systems. We know that we've got a lot of environmental issues associated with those systems in that relatively dense development. Within the master plan, we included capacities to ultimately serve those properties, as well as the potential for, almost tripling that capacity or that number of residential units in that area. Finally, the third land use that we took a look at was a stretch of about 1 mile along the corridor, which is largely undeveloped. We met with the property owners who have some fairly well-defined development plans consisting of mixed-use residential and commercial uses. Then, of course, we took a look at other issues such as topography and the normal type of issues. Once we completed the master plan, we had three failed attempts to put together public-private partnerships to try to put together a project to at least partially or completely extend utilities to the airport. We ran into several obstacles to accomplish that. The first obstacle was that approximately half of the corridor between the city of Brainerd and the airport is outside of the city limits. The first half mile is in a local or adjacent township, then there's a mile that's located in the city, and then the final mile is also in that same adjacent township. The dense residential development that I mentioned earlier is also in that township. The various meetings that we've had, we received very poor reception for any sort of a partnership to move forward with the utility project from the township residents. Their primary concern were costs of future utility extensions, which ultimately would result in special assessments or fees. So it was very difficult to bring them on board. On the private side, the 1 mile that is in the city and largely undeveloped, there was going to be substantial or excessive development costs associated with developing properties on both sides of the highway. The developer would be required to construct parallel water and sanitary sewer systems to serve those properties. So there was cost issues associated with that. The another issue that we kept running up against was the local economy. I'm sure, as the committee is aware, Brainerd is suffering from the highest unemployment rate for any outstate city with a population over 10,000. And a lot of landowners and developers just simply are reluctant to make major investments at this point in time until the economy starts showing some sort of a rebound. Finally, the airport itself is a regional airport that serves roughly four or five counties in central Minnesota. The city, as a joint owner with the county, is more than willing to participate in the cost of our financial responsibility to extend utilities on the airport property once they reach the airport property. But at this point in time, we're just not in any sort of a financial position to put our taxpayers at risk to extend the utilities from our current corporate limits to the airport. In summary, the benefits of the project, we can address the short-term needs of the airport to provide water and sanitary sewer as required by the Fire Marshal's Office. We can support their future development plans for industrial and aviation-related commercial development on the property. The project provides a backbone system so that we can, at some point in the future, extend water and sewer services to that dense residential development and address the environmental issues associated with that. Fourth, it provides a source for connections to water and sewer for potential economic development along the Highway 210 corridor where there currently is none. And we do believe that this utility project would be exactly the catalyst that we need to promote economic development along that 210 corridor. The project costs, we had to update project costs. Right now, the total project, we're estimating at a little over $7 million. From 2006 to 2013, we had to essentially double the cost of the water main. That's what's happened with material prices in the past 7 years, and we don't doubt that that's going to happen again in the future. If there's really one point that I'd like to leave the committee with, is that given our experience with trying to put together these public-private partnership and trying to put this project together and having several failed attempts at it, that without the bonding, quite frankly, this project just is not going to be completed.
Okay. Have you tried for PFA funds, Public Facility Authority funds, and is this the total amount of the project, or is that the amount you anticipate of public money with some other money being added to it?
This would be the total dollar amount, including engineering costs. So we don't anticipate any other private money being involved in, or public money being involved in the project.
And have you looked at the Public Facilities Authority?
We have, and the problem with that would be the debt service on those particular loans. We have looked at either bonding or PFA loans, but still putting our taxpayers at risk for the debt service for the loans is just something that we cannot afford to do. Given that most of the development is outside of our corporate limits.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you remember what the debt service was on if you were to do a PFA, go through the PFA route?
I do not remember exactly.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That puts a question going back to the first presenter's testimony about the state of Minnesota coming in and telling you that you have to, the fire inspector piece, that you have to have this completed by 2020.
April of 2016.
16 would mean then you really have not much of a choice with the idea that you have the DNR, you have the state patrol based out of there, you have this fire suppression unit based there. It would seem to me that, and that's a good question, Mr. Chair, about PFA funding, however, it seems to be more than even regional significance here. It really is a state, kind of a state collaboration issue. If they're telling you have to have this, I'm finally putting it together now. Thank you.
That's a very good point, Senator Gabritsky. We do that all the time with our small towns and cities and tell them they have to do something, and then we don't provide the money for it, and they can't afford to do it. So this is the kind of situation you're in, too. So any other comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Senator Rood. We'll lay this over for Senate File 1039. It'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the recommendation of the bonding committee.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And
thank
members,
you very much.
This is what we're going to do now. I have somebody from the Iron Range, so I'm going to do my bill, and then Senator Sparks will do Senator Metzen's bill, and then we'll go back to Senator Schmidt's bill. So we got about half an hour to do these three, and I think we can get them done.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, welcome to your committee.
Thank you.
Where's he been?
Not sure how much longer I'm staying either. thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good committee. Senator File 1525 is an appropriation for Giants Ridge Event Center, $4.9 million. And I would tell you everything about it except that I have two expert witnesses. And so just to save a little bit of time, I'll turn it over to either one. Commissioner, do you want to go first? Commissioner Tony Sertich is here to start.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for the opportunity to present before you today. My name is Tony Sertich, and I'm the commissioner of the IRRB. You're getting a handout here. I know you have some information in your packet. Probably the best handout is the one that you're receiving right now about this event center. Giants Ridge is a facility that we own at the IRRB. It's a ski hill and two golf courses. And in the early 1980s, a ski chalet was built for the ski hill portion of this. And as you see on one side of this sheet is the good news, the other side is the bad news. If you flip it over to the bad news is the multiple pictures, and we've seen a lot of disrepair happen to this facility. And a few things. It was built in the late 70s or early 80s, just like I was, and some things of that vintage aren't the best for the long term, and this facility is one of them. It's really built in a strip mall sort of way that really doesn't meet the needs of what of a facility that can be used all year round. And so the roof needs to be repaired. There's window work. There's dripping that's happening all the time. We worked with the state architect to look at this facility, and what they basically said as a rule of thumb is if you need to put in money that equals more than half of tearing down the facility, you should start from scratch all over again. And so that's what we'd be doing, is really an asset preservation of this ski hill and putting a facility up that will meet the needs of being available 365 all year long. And so the space would be better be able to be utilized for conferences, events, and those sorts of things. There is more than a one-to-one match. Our agency, just to remind you all, does not receive state funding. It has local funding dollars, non-state dollars, and we would match above and beyond the money that is requested today. And we are shovel-ready. If appropriated this year, we'd be constructing by later this year. I can briefly have Linda Johnson, who runs this facility for us, talk briefly about the economic impact to the region. And the one last thing I'll leave you with is this is really also a public-private partnership. Giants Ridge and the IRRB owns the ski hill and the two golf courses, but all of the development around it is private development, the lodging and the like. And so if you look since the early 1980s, there's been almost a 50-50 match. Our agency's invested about $45 million into the complex, and there's been private development up till now of $45 million, and we'd expect that to continue if we were able to upgrade this facility.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Linda Johnson. I'm the managing director at the Giants Ridge facility. As Commissioner Sertich had mentioned, the annual economic impact for the facility to the region is annually about $10 million plus. We host the state high school championships for alpine and Nordic skiing. We host a variety of conferences. We serve the local residents as well as destination guests. Our destination traffic is about 60% of our business, and 40% is made up of greater Minnesota
and the northeastern Minnesota region. So as Commissioner Sertich had stated, the facility is aging, infrastructure continues to fail. We have continued to make repairs over the past 15 years for sure, and it's just reached its life expectancy, and it's time to set the stage for the next 30 years for this facility for our region.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
So, members, this is something that we've been discussing for a number of years, and the time has come to do this, and it will actually add the next step to the what is an absolutely outstanding venue for not only golf but skiing, and for a huge tourist attraction to the area. And as Commissioner Sertich stated, tearing it down will cost about the same as remodeling it, and it just doesn't make any sense to remodel, and it's time to put up a new one. So I appreciate your support.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni, just for us new member and who are not familiar with the area, which city is this China Ridge is near?
Bywabic. Between Bywabic and Aurora, in fact. It's halfway okay. between.
Okay, thank you.
They're considered to be in Bywabic, but I think they have a mailing address of Aurora, if I'm not mistaken. No? They are in Bywabic, too?
Senator Dietze?
Swearingen. Doesn't Swearingen? Swearingen has a Bywabic address and an Aurora mailing.
It's across the road.
Yeah, okay.
We're just getting our range of answers.
Senator Dietze.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is this going to replace I'll preface this by saying this is where I spent Christmas for many, 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 many years here,
yep.
Including this past year. I did not go skiing because I spent my tourism dollars shopping in Virginia for Christmas gifts, so I'll preface that. Is this replacing, the ski chalet?
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, it is replacing the existing ski chalet. We have a variety of buildings, as you are aware, and it will replace the larger 15,000 square foot aging facility, and it will be directly on top of the sports dorm, if you're familiar with that building, and our ski school and ski patrol.
Okay.
And we are shovel ready and ready to go. So.
Yes, Senator Dietze.
Mr. Chair, and I have another question. So about how many acres is the public land?
For Mr. Chair, committee members, for skiing or just in total?
Just in general, because I'm
in general, we have about 1,600 acres of developable land. Our ski area is on 202 acres of terrain, and that does not include both of our golf courses, which are both 18 hole.
Okay, one more question, Senator. Yeah,
thank you. So this could be potentially a regional park.
and just so you know, we don't have any parameters on ours just yet, I don't think it says park in front of it, but we'll take the regional park money.
You have the visitors. You've got visitors from all over the. I mean, when we've been up there at Christmas, there's visitors from not just the local area, and I know all over the schools.
Senator Dietzick, we'll take the money.
Any other comment from committee members? Okay.
Thank you.
With that, Senate File 1525 will be laid over for recommendation to Capital Investment Committee for Inclusion and the Omnibus Bonding Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Spock for Senate File 478. Senator Spark, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 478. We all know that there's only one and only Senator Metzen, but I'm pinch hitting for him today. And so I think with that, and I think this goes to the point, Senator Dietzick, too, that rural and metro can work together because this bill is for the metro cities. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Patty Nauman, the Executive Director for Metro Cities.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Nauman, welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We are an organization that represents cities at both the legislature, executive branch, and Metropolitan Council and on issues of regional and statewide significance. It's my opportunity to come before you today to present our bonding request, which is intended to assist cities in the metropolitan area with the mitigation of issues associated with inflow and infiltration, which is a very important problem across the state, and I'll talk about why we're here for cities in the metro area specifically. This is a $4 million capital appropriation request that would assist cities, as I said, with inflow and infiltration mitigation. In the metropolitan area, more than 100 communities own and operate local sewer systems that are connected to the regional wastewater treatment system. The Metropolitan Council provides wastewater treatment services, which are designed to accommodate the region's future growth, be affordable to ratepayers, and meet state and federal clean water standards. A primary challenge for the regional system and its capacity is this issue of significant inflow and infiltration, which is essentially clear water that flows from municipal wastewater collection systems that ends up going into the regional wastewater treatment system. Inflow and infiltration occur essentially when groundwater or rainwater, which are both essentially clear water, enter the regional sanitary sewer system through defects in local sewer infrastructure. Sources of infiltration, which is groundwater, are typically cracks in pipes, leaky manholes, leaky joints, pardon me, and deteriorating manholes. Sources of inflow are typically direct connections to the sanitary sewer system, such as cross connections, foundation drains, and illegal sump pumps. Inflow typically occurs in direct proportion to rainfall. In the metropolitan area, many communities are experiencing what we call excess inflow and infiltration, resulting from this defective public and private local sewer infrastructure, which allows for this excess flow to enter the region's wastewater plants. This is a major concern for the region. Actually, it is a concern for the state, as I mentioned, because inflow and infiltration means that clear water is flowing into the system and using capacity that is intended to accommodate regional growth and population. It's not designed to accommodate this kind of problem. So clear water that ends up not being treated is taking up this capacity in the wastewater pipes. Excess INI also presents a potential public health threat. It can result in sanitary sewer overflows, it can and does, which violate clean water standards and threaten the safety of the region's water supply. Correcting INI can generally be done in two ways. You can correct it at the local level through repairs to local sewer infrastructure or by adding additional regional wastewater capacity. The Metropolitan Council has estimated that correcting the problem at the local level is estimated at this point, I think, to cost about $150 million. If we end up if we don't correct it at the local level and end up dealing with providing additional wastewater treatment capacity at the regional level, that comes with a much higher price tag of $1 billion. This is not probably the most bright and shiny bonding project that you will see come before your committee, but it is work that is about maintaining our very basic public infrastructure, which, although we don't see it, is very fundamental to each and every one of us every day, something we don't tend to notice until there's a crisis, at which point everybody notices and it truly becomes a crisis. The Met Council, I just want to make a couple of more points. In response to these issues in 2007, did institute implement a surcharge program, which we lovingly call a fine, in which they assess cities a surcharge if they are found to be contributing excess INI into the regional wastewater pipes. A city can avoid those charges if they make improvements to their local sewer infrastructure. If they don't, then the council essentially adds that charge into their regional wastewater bill. Cities are working very hard to correct these issues. It's a very costly problem. This bonding money is intended to help assist with some of those repairs and to try to, it's something that benefits the entire region and obviously saves a lot of money long term if we don't end up having to build additional regional wastewater capacity. Jason Ouellette, who is the finance director for the Met Council Environmental Services Office, is also here to answer questions, and I don't know, Jason, if you had a few points you wanted to make. So I'll turn it over to him. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Ouellette. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jason Ouellette. I'm Finance and Energy Director for the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. This is a Metro Cities initiative, but it's a very important program for the Metropolitan Council. As she said, there's substantial amount of utility savings. It's a very high priority for the wastewater system of the metro area that's now serving 107 cities I could list many of those and the ones that have gotten some help in this before, but I think just to save you time, I just want to say this is a water quality issue. It saves on the risk of spills and outflow into groundwater. It's a water supply issue because it saves clear water going into the groundwater instead of being flushed down the rivers. It's a utility management issue. Patty Nauman has mentioned $1 billion of unnecessary capacity that we would have had to have built. And frankly, in other metropolitan areas around the country, they've had multi-billion dollar consent decrees with the EPA over this sort of thing. So we're avoiding all of that regulatory risk. And of course, creating jobs. And in the previous programs, we've leveraged quite a bit of municipal money. I think the last one was about 22% state money, and the rest of it came from the local cities. In terms of the surcharges she mentioned, actually, there have been about 50 cities that have gotten preliminary surcharges from us. We don't think of it as a fine, but as a cost of service if they continue to do this. 49 of them have gotten completely out of that. They've done the right thing, and they fixed that. One city didn't. We actually did surcharge them, but then within a couple of years, they got it together, and we rebated all that money. So there really hasn't been any surcharge, but it's a program that we need to continue to make a high priority for water in this state.
Thank you, Mr. Roulette. Senator Dietzit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the average? I mean, I know this is expensive for cities, but just to give us an idea, what's the average amount that cities pay to fix this problem? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I can tell you in the last program there was $19 million spent by the 30 cities that got grants. There were some that didn't as well. I think we've spent almost $100 million on II work on the municipal side since the program started in about 2007.
She's asking about the average.
Okay, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, how do you determine which cities get this help? Because I know we did this in my city, and I'm wondering, and if you don't get help, then you add it on to the local sewer bills, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, to the extent that the communities do the programs, they'll have to fund that somehow, and they may use other monies. I'm not really sure whether that's stormwater funds or whatever. Certainly, there's local sewer bills is an option. I'm sorry, I forgot the rest of your question.
The question was, how do you determine which cities get it rather than having them pay for it themselves?
Thank you. I'm sorry, I forgot that. We did have quite a process, a public process, last time around. First thing we would do is look at whatever requirements you would put in the appropriation. We would review MMB requirements for use of state dollars that have been somewhat problematic for local sewer projects sometimes in the past. Certainly speak with the sponsors about what they would want. We would draft program guidelines, as we did in the past, that talked about what part was eligible and how we would manage it if we were oversubscribed, as we were in last year's program. We would review with the committees of the council. We did have a public meeting so that anybody could comment. Then we reviewed again with the committees of the council, and they adopted the guidelines. And we then put out the opportunity to apply for the grant money.
Mr. Lule, can you elaborate how quickly the money was spent from last time?
Mr. Chair, the 2012 program is still in process right now. Some of that has been spent, but there was quite a bureaucratic process. You know, we have to sign a grant agreement and all that. And I'm not sure actually if any of that money has actually gone and been reimbursed to the cities, but they're eligible for money that they spent last year. So the 2010 money was all spent. The 2012 money is all awarded. In fact, we awarded a little more because we had some come back from 2010. But it hasn't been reimbursed through us at this point. So the cities may be carrying the cash flow themselves. I'm not really sure. But we certainly do anticipate this construction season that most of it will be done.
Okay. Thank you. Any question from committee member? Senator Ingebritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I stepped out of the room. We are talking about Senate File 478.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. I did finally figure that out when he identified himself as working for the Metropolitan Council. My question would be, only because I don't know, how many municipalities are involved in the Metropolitan Council?
Mr. Chair and Senator. I think that...
I believe it's 141.
141 communities? So my follow-up question would be then, so they would come to this council for the dollars. So the cost, it costs money to administer these types of programs. How much of the $4 million that if you it would be to appropriate it, how much of that would go towards administering that grant, I guess I would say?
Mr. Chair and Senator, first of all, the 140 includes a few cities that are not served by our sewer system. We're serving 107 at this moment. So unless you tell us to make those smaller communities outside the urban area eligible, we would anticipate just those that we serve, the 107 cities. We have not asked for or recovered any administrative costs. The regional money has done that. A little bit of time that we put in, passing it through from the state to the cities, has been swallowed in the rate base for the regional sewer system. It would be very small.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. With that, we will lay over Senate 5478 over for recommendation to the capital investment for inclusion in an omnibus bonding bill. Thank you, Senator Spahr. Back to you.
Thank you, Senator Schmidt, for being patient. Members, while Senator Schmidt's coming up tomorrow, we're meeting at noon, right? And we have another long list of bonding projects, and if we don't get them done within the designated time of the committee, we'll go across the hall to 112 to finish it off, because we've got to get all these done sometime soon. So we're going to try and get them done on Thursday so we don't have to meet on Friday. We'll do the best we can. Senator Schmidt, go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members here. I anticipate we'll have a few bills before this committee regarding silica sand mining, and I expect this will probably be the quickest conversation we have. Just to lead off the conversation here, we have the world's best sand in the world's probably worst space down in southeastern Minnesota. And what this bill tries to do is protect sensitive areas of land by trout streams and specifically wellhead areas that feed public wells. And what we're asking for is an unspecified amount of dollars be appropriated on the DNR for protection into permanent easement of land that is by the wellhead feeding areas here. And what we're looking to do is just make sure that if we remove a filter layer of sand in a very sensitive area in southeastern Minnesota, that we're not increasing the likelihood of damaging our aquifers or our water table. And this puts in place a mechanism for allowing landowners to essentially monetize their land to do reasonably well by putting in permanent easement the land that's most sensitive. And with that said, I guess we're cutting close to the end here. I'll allow my testifiers to provide some additional testimony here on this bill, and be happy to ask any or answer any questions that you may have in terms of what we're trying to accomplish here.
Thank you for your patience. Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Tim Kohler, and I am with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And at the second part, subdivision 2 there on the easement section, I just wanted to just comment on our capacity at the board to implement the RIM Reserve program, the Reinvest in Minnesota program. As most of you know, we've been working with this program for about 27 years, and working through local conservation districts, and we feel like we have the capacity with them and the authorities with the RIM statutes to implement provisions of this proposed bill. So I'll try to keep it as short as possible.
Well, that surprised me.
I threw in 20, Mr. Chairman, 27 years. I had to get some, some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to the RIM project being relatively new, 27 years, I guess the only question I have had is with regards to silica sand mining protection. You've been dealing with these areas for that period of time. Have you ever had any troubles at all with your protection in those areas? Have you ever experienced any of that? Or is it just most recent in the last, I think we've all been hearing something about silica sand for the last maybe 4 or 5 years.
Mr. Kaler.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator, with the RIM program, as we have about a little over 6,000 easements statewide, and we have had a number of easements for groundwater-specific protection, and so it basically is the same type of easement that we would have for other protections. It generally would be a permanent easement. It would restrict most uses. And it would basically be a voluntary thing that a landowner would come to us and ask to be a part of. We would work with them and basically secure that easement and control the use of that land for the purposes as we were talked about here in the bill. So,
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Schmidt, it seems to me that these parcels that are wellhead protection wouldn't be issued a permit to mine in any way, would they? I mean, if you're the city or the jurisdiction that's drawing their water out of that area, why would they issue a permit for somebody to mine over their water source?
You know that, Senator Schmidt, or one of your witnesses know the answer to that?
I would defer that question. I could take a stab at it, but I'd just as soon allow the experts to address that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Randy Ellingbo, and I'm with the Section of Drinking Water Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health. And our section is responsible for administering both the Safe Drinking Water Act as well as the wellhead protection rules here in Minnesota. And in regard to your question, maybe a very brief background. Public water supplies are required to develop wellhead protection plans, and we assist them with that in a couple ways. We help them delineate their wellhead protection area, also called a drinking water source management area, and we'll also often help them develop management plans to reduce the potential for groundwater contamination in that area around the wells. The authorities for the public water supplies and often associated municipalities vary, meaning the public water supply itself or the city may not have authority to develop local ordinance and control land uses within the wellhead protection area. And so part of the plan, of course, is to not only identify potential sources of pollution, but identify ways that groundwater pollution might be prevented. And so if they have ordinance authority available because it's within the city boundaries, for example, then they might have that ability to themselves prohibit under their own authority activities like mining. Elsewhere, though, the wellhead areas are controlled by local landowners and not subject to those local ordinances. That's where other tools may come into play, like the RIM easements that the Department of Health assists the Board of Water and Soil Resources in assessing their usefulness. There's some other tools available, like cost share and grants for things that will help implement those wellhead protection plans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I didn't catch your name. Apologize for that. So if it's a farm field, the Department of Ag would have some authority over the practices that the farmer's utilizing there that might be a potential problem for the groundwater. Is there no state agency currently that would have the oversight over these proposed mine facilities?
Mr. Ellingbo.
Well, I can't speak comprehensively about all of the potential controls over mining. That's not my area of expertise. What I can talk about just is the Minnesota Department of Health's authorities regarding wellhead protection areas. And our authority is limited to requiring the public water supplies to develop those plans. We do provide technical assistance and sometimes financial assistance to help implement those. But, for example, we require them to create the plans. We don't have authority at the Department of Health to limit the activities within that zone. Other types of authorities regarding mining, I'd have to defer to someone else. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Senate staff could help me here, but it seems to me that DNR or MPCA or somebody would have the ability to impact the activity if it's going to be a potential negative to the groundwater. I'm sure that the Department of Ag does on ag land, because in the city of Park Rapids, their wellhead is potato fields, and they're regulating what the rotation crops are to impact potential nitrate contamination. So doesn't one of the current state agencies have regulatory authority over groundwater in that type of activity?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, I think the witness kind of stated it correctly. I mean, wellhead protection is left up to the local unit of government, and if they don't have control over the area, if the wellhead is outside of their jurisdiction, they really have no means through their powers to control activities on the land within that area. The state agencies, I mean, there would be some allowance for state agencies, but they don't really permit these areas. You know, like pesticides or whatever that are applied to the landscape. You know, the Department of Ag has general authority for all application of pesticides. They have to follow the label and that sort of thing. But these areas they're trying to get a higher level of protection than just the run-of-the-mill application of those chemicals to the landscape. And I do want to point out that this is specifically eligible under the RIM statute. There's a provision that says that for RIM, land is eligible if the land is a wellhead protection area as defined by the same reference in here and has a wellhead protection plan approved by the Commissioner of Health. So if there's a wellhead protection plan that's been approved by the Commissioner, they are specifically eligible for RIM. And that is how the legislature's dealt with these in the past and how it could be dealt with in the future is providing the money to buy up the permanent easement. I know there are other wellhead protection areas around the state that have gone through this process in the past. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the information.
Senator Scoia, was there your question, though, about the permit to mine and who would issue it? Was that answered?
Well, I think I got my answer out of that. I think I know what's going on with regard to the agriculture areas that are outside of the city's jurisdiction that are being regulated somewhat by wellhead protection. I think I understand how that's happening. I am a little bit surprised that somewhere in Minnesota DNR or MPCA that they wouldn't have some permit authority over these activities that are going to potentially affect groundwater.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, the Chair specifically asked about permit to mine. These are surface minerals, so they are not, DNR does not regulate, does not require, there's no permit to mine required from DNR. It's permit at the local level. If there's an air emission, PCA.
But I think that's
involved.
What Senator Scoia asked, if the local level would even issue a permit if the wellhead was in danger.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, one of the issues is going to be when the wellhead is outside the jurisdiction of the local government unit. So it's a different local unit of government that they may not even require a permit to mine sand and gravel or silica sand in this case situation.
And there's no state agency because it's a surface mine.
And unless PCA would get involved with it, they get involved with discharges, air emissions, water discharges, things like that, but not necessarily on a mine basis.
Isn't Polymet a surface mine?
Mr. Chair,
you don't have to go into that.
Surface interest.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, I think what we're trying to do here is provide another tool in the toolbox in order to help get this right. I mean, we have the opportunity for ordinances and permitting at the local level. Of course, what we're trying to target here is those lands that lie outside of a city or a township. We also have the ability to set state standards. But outside of that, outside of the applicability of state agency permitting, this is another tool that could be utilized. And instead of having a standard offset, for instance, away from a creek or a wellhead, this is a way of trying to strike a middle ground here and give folks a choice to opt in and put their certain sensitive lands in their possession in permanent easement.
Senator Scoia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt. Yes, I think I understand what the attempt is here. It's just some of us have a longstanding resistance to these type of easements, and some of us think that there might be better mechanisms for accomplishing the same goal. My concern with them is that the landowner sells the easement through the rim mechanism or whatever it is, and then the value of the land is diminished, and the cost of that services on those parcels then shifts onto the other landowners in the area. And that's been my kind of my long-standing concern about those, and we're actually having pretty ongoing discussion about that in the tax committee.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also echo those kinds of concerns with regards to mining. This has been going on, I think, for some time in the state of Minnesota, these open pit mines with regards to silica sand, and I'm wondering, and I've had a short discussion with Senator Schmidt with regards to this, as to what of the current system is broken, I guess, is what I'm wondering, and I certainly would echo again what Senator Scoy is talking about, that if we're getting too close to a stream or a river, I would think there'd be a mechanism in place that the DNR is going to step up and get involved in that. I would think. I don't know if they're here to testify to that or not, but just a comment, I guess. And as far as a tool in the toolbox, I understand, Senator Schmidt, you're moving forward with this stuff, and I can appreciate that, and I'm glad we're starting to discuss it, and we can get to it here eventually. So, but it's been going on for quite some time, I understand, in the state, and maybe at larger amounts now, and there's a concern all of a sudden.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, I mean, the concern is the volume of activity here. It's not simply the fact that we're doing it. It's just to what extent and what's the concentration of this activity in a given geography. And I think that's what we're trying to prepare for and give our local units of government and our state agencies and citizens the tools they need, you know, in order to strike the right balance here. And, southeastern Minnesota, it's a very sensitive topography with the karst geography, very quick access to the water table, to aquifers, and the sand layer serves, it's not simply sand, it's a filter between the ground level and that aquifer. And so my view here is that this is one tool that can be utilized to protect the most sensitive areas in southeastern Minnesota. It, by no means is it the only option here, and I just say that what we're trying to do is identify a couple of different approaches that help protect the most sensitive areas. And I guess the alternative to this sort of thing is, you know, strict standards that say you have to be offset certain, you know, distances from streams or from wellheads. And, you know, some may argue that may be the wrong approach. So this is somewhere in the middle there, and I think we're just trying to identify what sorts of options we can have in getting this right.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Schmidt. But it appears to me that this approach is voluntary by the landowner. I mean, the current landowner would have to be willing to place the easement on his property in order to protect the groundwater.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's correct.
Okay, you have a couple more witnesses, or are you done?
You know, I actually, do you have anything to say? Or
No. Okay. That's how we saw it, was as a tool in the toolbox.
And is Mr. Persons, or excuse me, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if anyone here, and I don't know if it's Senator Schmidt, but if you're applying for RIM dollars, isn't there a federal match? And what would that percentage be? Maybe somebody else at the table knows.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there are none of our federal partners are here today. I used to be in a seat over on the other side of town. Right now, there's not an identified federal match with this proposal. There are some potential federal matches that could be sought at a later time or at, you know, later. But right now, it's just a standalone RIM proposal, or as the first part talks about, an SNA proposal from a DNR.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, what kind of money are we talking for a RIM easement here? Seems to me if you're buying it and taking away the ability to mine the sand, I mean, it's quite a bit of value there, or how much money are we talking?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I could speak just generally here. I think we're talking about approximately $100,000 per easement, and that gets you approximately 15 acres. And I think that's kind of the back of the envelope kind of breakdown and calculation there. So we don't have a dollar figure put in here. I mean, obviously it's a scale. I mean, the more money you put in, the more land that you're in a position to protect. I guess I would defer if there's any additional clarity or...
And Mr. Chairman and Senators, you know that the issue of valuation has come up in, I think, almost every committee in the Senate and the House this year. We're with Bowser, Board of Water and Soil Resources. Our board makes that determination on rates, but the valuation that we use, that the process we would use the same statutes that governs the rest of the RIM programs. And so as far as paying more money or less money for a particular site here, that hasn't, you know, we haven't even gotten to that point yet. We were using some average numbers for the senator, and in that part of the state, we're paying close to $6,000 an acre for cropland for RIM. We just haven't gotten to the point of working with our board and local people and others to figure out whether that's the right rate to use or what values, but that's the current rate is based on roughly 90% of the tax assessed value. So just for clarification.
So, have you, we sell or buy permanent easements. Have you ever seen an arrangement where a permanent easement's been taken out? Is there an ability to do that, short of a state statute in the future that changes the ability to get rid of the permanent easement?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, our board, we're governed by the 103 statute, first of all, and our board has the ability to consider a release of an easement. Generally, the conditions are very narrow that would allow that release, and out of the roughly 6,000 easements that we've had, we've released a handful of them over the 27-year period. Generally for like an infrastructure, need to straighten a road type of a thing, or due to some situations that primarily deal with infrastructure stuff, but also some other reasons for trying to think of another one but bottom line is that for somebody who just doesn't want their easement anymore, our board is not able to just release and re-put easements in and out whenever they want to. I mean, it's a pretty stringent policy. We pay once, basically, for that easement. And it's pretty hard to get out of that easement just from a from that perspective.
Senator Schmidt, just generally, is this a kind of a hodgepodge way around getting stopping mining? I mean, I know there's been a push by some in your area to really eliminate or diminish the ability to mine some of these sands. How does this factor into that equation or not at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I appreciate the question. I'm sure that's on some minds here. This in no way is an attempt to put in place a de facto moratorium or anything like that, or to prohibit sand mining generally in the region. My view, and I tell people this all the time down in my area, is that we've been mining in Minnesota for a long time. It's made our state in many regards. We don't call the Iron Range for no reason. And we've been mining aggregate in southeastern Minnesota. We're going to mine silica sand in southeastern Minnesota. But we have an opportunity right now, as you look across the river, to see what's happened there and how local communities have been inundated and flooded with mining activity. We have an opportunity to be proactive, to answer questions that we know are out there right now regarding water volume and quality, air, traffic impacts. And in this case, we have an opportunity to add a tool to the tool chest and make sure that we're protecting our waters. There's a lot of sensitive land down in southeastern Minnesota. And in my view, this is just one tool in order to protect the most sensitive land. I think if we were to drop a map and show areas that were potentially be placed into easement, there would leave a lot of land for silica sand mining in southeastern Minnesota. What we're trying to do with this bill simply is to protect the most sensitive land and in the most, I guess, the land that could adversely affect our water if it were to be mined. And that's simply what we're trying to do. And I'm leveling with you here that's the beginning and the end of it.
But Senator Schmidt, I appreciate your answer on this, and this bill potentially just does a basic limitation on the key areas that you talk about, but I know you've authored other bills, and I'm just wondering collectively how do these all play together, and does this become just a tool in the toolbox of other tools that collectively shut down the mining opportunity we have in our state?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I can say with great certainty that we're not going to leave town here and shut down silica sand mining in southeastern Minnesota. What we're trying to do is be proactive, address a number of questions relating to air, water, and transportation impacts, to define roles for state agencies, to empower local decision makers so that they have answers to these questions up front so they don't get halfway through the permitting process and still don't know what they're getting into. And I think that that's what we're trying to accomplish in the collection of bills that I'm putting forward here. And at the end of the day, I think we're going to strike the right balance, and we'll leave town with clarity and with a process put in place that answers a number of those questions that linger out there. So I'll say it one more time. I mean, we've mined in Minnesota for a long time. We're going to continue to mine in Minnesota. We're going to mine silica sand in southeastern Minnesota. But let's be ready to do it responsibly and know what we're getting into. And that's all I'm asking through this legislation and the other two pieces that I hope will be before this committee in short order.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know, or has anybody looked at, in some of the areas, have they done like an overlay of showing where we may already have some different types of easements, and so we have an idea of pockets of where there already are easements and then where you may need them, so we have an idea of what we're looking at? Has that been done at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator, what we do is we have a map that focuses on southeastern Minnesota of our trout streams, of our fens, of our sensitive water areas. And we have that map, and we could certainly provide that to the committee and share it with you. I have a feeling we're going to be back in front of this group talking about silica sand in the future, and I'd be happy to share that with the committee. I don't know if folks on either side of me would like to add to that at all. I know that we do have the information on where the water is. I don't know where easements are in place right now, though.
Can you add to that answer? Because I didn't understand your answer to the cost, and I think you said it's $100,000 per easement, and there's 15 acres. Is that 15 easements, or is that one easement?
Mr. Chair, what I had said, this is a previous question, a couple questions back, is that the typical easement in southeastern Minnesota runs about $6,000 an acre. And so if you were to look at that, $1 million in appropriation would get you approximately 10 easements with an average size of 15 acres per easement. That's just an average. That's kind of just a back-of-the-envelope calculation.
That's way more clear than the other answer you gave. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I appreciate your answer here and your frankness. I'm going to make an unofficial request if I can, Mr. Chair.
Make
I guess
official if you want.
Well, if I wanted to be on policy, I would have been on policy. As you know, probably where I'm going here, and when I say 4 to 5 years, this has been on the horizon. The silica sand mining, as you and I had discussed on the floor in the Senate, had been coming to my committee, and there was going to be a time when we were certainly going to have to sit down and deal with it. But due to the fact that we're going to be looking at expending some dollars, and we don't know exactly what, I'm wondering if the chair would indulge some more information, maybe some policy-type information to the committee to better understand how long it's been going on and why it is a concern now to those that are concerned. I don't know. You don't have a lot of time, I get that.
I think Senator Schmidt's got a couple other bills that, like them or not like them, I think they're probably going to be in front of this committee, and we're probably going to have some time to talk
about
it.
So, Mr. Chair, there will be some people here, both pro and con, for the silicon mining.
I would think so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize again for not remembering your name.
Mr.
Ellingbo. So, Mr. Ellingbo, when you're protecting a wellhead area, what is the kind of the average size of those wellhead areas? I mean, they would be potentially 100 acres or more? How are we thinking about these areas that need protection size?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, the size of the wellhead protection areas vary based on soils and the geology of the area, of course, and that could vary from tens of acres to over 100. That's not unusual, and so it is a considerable area. Typically, what we look for is what's called that zone that would be within the 10-year time of travel, and so how far groundwater might move in 10 years, and that is totally dependent on geology and soil conditions at the site and groundwater conditions. So it's variable.
Sure. Mr. Chair, and if you're in an area that has real tight clays, the wellhead would be smaller, but if you're in an area that has karst and sands in it, the wellhead would be larger? Would that be kind of a general statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, that would be true. The other factor that I didn't mention in the original was that the amount of water withdrawn also has an impact on that. That's really critical. You know, if you're not using much, that zone is going to be pretty small. If you are a large user, it can be very large. So
Mr. Chair, so for a city, it would be a large area. If it's just a thing, it could be quite small.
Anything? Do you have more witnesses?
This is it, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And to Senator Ingebrigtsen's, I guess, request previously, if you'll indulge us, we'll be happy to provide you with a lot of policy background on this issue. And we'll come to you with a bill that you may like, you may dislike, or maybe you'll love it. So I look forward to that conversation.
You know, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's my understanding of these divisions that we can have policy as long as there's money tied to them.
So, there you go.
We can discuss as much policy
there
as
you
we
go.
Want.
You know what? I'm down here, you know, Monday through Thursday, Friday, whatever, so I can do evenings, too. I'm wide open to that.
Senator Scoy.
And, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to tell Senator Smith that I stuck around specifically for this bill, and I'm going to be looking forward to the next two that are coming forward.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I promise I'll give us all a lot to talk about.
That's good.
It won't be anytime soon, but it's coming.
Uh-huh.
All right. Okay, with that, members, I thank you very much for your patience today. You all did a really nice job of hanging around, and we will lay Senate File 425 over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the Bonding Committee. So thank you all very much, and like I said, tomorrow we're going to have a whole bunch more bonding bills, and hopefully we can get them done within the time frame. If not, we'll continue across the hall. So thank you all very much, and meeting adjourned.